It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech. A great panel for you. Ben Thompson joins us from Taiwan, Serenity Caldwell from Boston, and from the UK via San Francisco, Ian Thompson of The Register. We're going to talk about, well, CES aftermath, the Oculus Rift, Xiaomi, the Chinese phone company that's coming on strong, and a whole lot more. This Week in Tech is next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 493, recorded Sunday, January 18th, 2015. Adorable Kitten App. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the price, because everyone deserves a great night's sleep. Get $50 off any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/TWIT and enter the promo code TWIT. And by NatureBox. NatureBox ships great-tasting snacks right to your door. Start snacking smarter with wholesome, delicious treats like roasted Peruvian corn kernels. I'll take two. To get your complimentary NatureBox sampler, visit naturebox.com/TWIT. That's naturebox.com/TWIT. And by lynda.com. Invest in yourself for 2015. Lynda.com has thousands of courses to help you learn new tech, business, and creative skills. For a free 10-day trial, visit lynda.com/TWIT2. That's lynda.com/TWIT2. And by Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. Find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple product is worth at gazelle.com. It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech, the show where we talk about the week in tech. Aptly named, do what? great panel here. We do have a lot to talk about. Let's start with Serenity Caldwell, just back from CES via iMore.com. You were part of that big Mobile Nations. You took over the old booth that we used to use.
Yeah, CES Live. We did it with Geekbeat and Tom's
Hardware. Yeah, it was great.
Yeah, it was really fun.
And you were the star of the show, I might add.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah. But Renee Ritchie was, I mean, you had a good bunch of supporting cast.
Yeah, I feel like Georgia Dow and Anthony Caselli get all the props because Georgia is basically the queen of making crazy videos at trade shows. And I was basically stealing all of her stuff. And then Anthony, her husband, was the one sort of filming all of it all the time. It was a blast, a really, really good time.
It's great to have you back. We'll ask you what you saw and liked and thought was of interest there. Also with us, a first timer from The Register, which is, of course, the greatest place to go to get tech snark. I've been reading it for how long? It's been a long time. Ian Thompson is here. Hi, Ian.
Hi there. Thank you.
When did The Register start?
94.
Wow.
Yeah.
20 years.
We are old men. It's just started out as an email list and then went web. And sometimes I was talking to the publisher last week and he was just like, yeah, it's 20 years. We should do something, but we're kind of busy. So just let's carry on. You know.
And of course, the great vulture logo, the icon.
Biting the hand that feeds IT, indeed.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Was it more IT focused in the early days?
It was totally IT focused. Yeah. I mean, the whole thing was a reaction against all the computing magazines were so terrible faced.
Yeah.
And it was like, and this computer does this and it has this and this and this. And it was just like, oh, let's have some fun. You know, I mean, so we took the tabloid style, red top tabloids from the UK style and applied that to the headlines. And people seem to like it. So we're hanging around for a while.
And great writing in kind of the tradition of, you know, The Spectator and Punch and the great British.
So much in Silicon Valley is just aching to have
it.
I mean, there are an awful lot of people with massive sticks up their backs who really should just chill out and take themselves a lot less seriously.
And you've been how long in the States? Were you assigned here? Like,
I came over for a year's posting in 2008. And I've got to say, it's a lovely place to live. And I kept on extending and extending.
Great.
And and now I've met a local girl and settled down. I think I'll be here for the duration. So... also, British winters are terrible this time of year.
Much better here.
Oh, yes.
Much better here.
Distinct lack of snow, but, you know, can't have everything.
I've been stalling because I want to wait till till the game finishes. And I think it just finished. So It's my guess. It just finished, so we can now welcome. Are you a Seahawks fan or a Packers fan, Ben Thompson?
I'm a Packers fan, and it's not over, but Seattle just took the lead. So, yeah. It's
minute 25. Yeah, it's not over. In fact, you probably won't be with us for another couple of minutes.
Well, I don't have it. It's not on TV here, so.
Oh,
It's more muddling along with
the. Can we point a camera at the? We got to figure, because I got to do this without violating NFL rules, but I think we could feed you our video. And then you'd really be distracted.
I could stream. I could find ways to stream it. But that would ruin the stream. But
we should mention that Ben Thompson, of course, at Stratechery, which is the best, most insightful independent tech blog I know of, is in Taipei, Taiwan. So
yes,
and it's early in the morning.
Agonizing through the end of this game here.
Yeah, I didn't know you were a Packers fan.
It's looking a little grim right now.
I wouldn't have booked you. You know what? You got Aaron Rodgers. He's got a great 2-minute drill. I think it's not over till the linebacker sings.
Yeah, I looked at the times actually, and I think I must have miscalculated the time zone because I was sure it'd be well over by now. But that's fine.
You're not watching. What are you watching? Like a text feed? Are you somebody texting you the score?
No, I mean you could follow the game cast.
In NFL.com they have kind of a thing.
Mm. Yep.
Yeah. I'll give you a play by play.
No, I mean,
so it's, now it's a big guy in a black outfit as it looks like he's wearing tights, I'll have to say, and he's running, he's kicking the ball. It looks like it was, he kicked it all the way down to the other end. So that's good, right? And then a guy's running with it, but they, oh my God, they're hurting him. and then some people are running.
We'll
So Aaron Rodgers has 12 game-winning drives and 37 opportunities. He's 32% for this particular situation. But I tell you, there are not many quarterbacks in the NFL you'd rather have there. I'll tell you what, Ben, you keep watching the game. There we go. We have the footage now.
I dialed into a feed direct from the game.
Number one is running around.
He's running. Really exciting.
Number
game,
two is in a fist fight, it looks like, but he's fallen down now. And now number one's running around in a circle.
He's actually decided
to go back the other way.
This is the most crazy.
And number two is again fallen down. That's terrible. Number one's just running back and forth and forth and back. It's terrible. I think that's Russell Wilson, isn't it? Just the humanity.
This is cruel here. He's just playing with the other team.
Touchdown for Tecmo.
This is a classic. Yeah, it's a Tecmo Bowl, and you beat Bo Jackson, and you basically see if you can run the entire quarter.
Oh, that's interesting. Really?
This is an old classic.
Is it Atari, Sega? What is that?
No, this is Nintendo.
Yeah,
Nintendo.
NES.
Yeah.
Huh.
Tecmo. So the idea is you just keep running until they tackle you.
Bo Jackson was basically unstoppable in this game. And so, yeah, the goal was to do a running play on the first play and then see if you could run out the entire quarter.
And I guess this is a speed run because, Bo Jackson, touchdown.
There you go.
Bo knows football and baseball.
Oh, boy.
So I figure out a way to distract so that Ben can continue to watch the game. I'm just going to ask Ian about. Hey, what about that David Cameron? Huh?
I am so sorry.
British Prime Minister David Cameron. We actually should get the video of this. He's speaking at something called
Not Shame,
the future. But now there's an election coming up.
Yeah, there's an election coming up. We choose when the government chooses when it has its election, but it has a deadline. So he has to call it by May 7th.
Yeah.
So there's some heavy electioneering going on, which is why he's over here with Obama to sort of show that he can pal it up with the world leaders just like everyone else, even though the two apparently don't get on that well, if gossip is to be believed anyway.
So he, and is he challenged by UKIP or?
UKIP will only take supporters really from the Conservatives because they're kind of like the rabid wing of the Conservative Party whose attitude towards foreigners is standing at the English Channel and shouting, just leave the wine and cheese and bugger off. You know, it's just.
I hypothesize that maybe he's feeling some heat from UKIP and has to kind of be strong.
Yeah, he's this is very much, I mean, he's seen as a very sort of limp character, if you like. And he needs to try and sort of beef up the toughness of the Conservative Party to try and hold off UKIP. On this, he's barking completely up the wrong tree.
He said that he believed that it would be critical for law enforcement, and this is in the wake of the terrorist attacks at Paris,
yeah.
that there be no communications that law enforcement can't read.
Yes.
In other words, no crypto, or crypto must always have a backdoor for law enforcement. And he said there's nothing to fear here because the Home Secretary will have to sign a warrant.
Yes.
So what's all the worry about this?
Well, that's part of the problem. The Home Secretary is Theresa May, who is, let's just say she's technology challenged, would be a nice way to put it. And when it comes to human rights, was famously criticized by her predecessor in the position as making remarks that were described as childlike and incompetent. And when he was forced to apologize because he was conservative and fellow conservative, he said, "I regret the language that I used." And does that mean you regret the words? The language that I used. It was.
And yet he was careful not to call for a new law.
Well, I think, to be honest, he's calling for this, but he must know deep down, that this isn't going to work. The security services would love something like this. He would introduce a new law in the next session of Parliament, is what he's saying, to ban encrypted applications. Whether or not he could get it through and whether or not he might see sense before then remains to be seen. But it's electioneering, so there's a certain flexibility in what you say you will do and what you'll actually do, because it's really just at this stage trying to garner as many votes as possible.
It does seem to me, and I got a lot of emails from our UK viewers showing real concern, but it does seem to me that almost impossible to enforce a law,
yes,
that prevents encryption.
Well, this is it. I mean, Apple and Google and Microsoft are going up against their own government about this. So if they honestly believe that their former colonial masters are going to be able to say, actually, you're going to have to do what we want you to do, not going to happen. So it's one of those things that sounds like a great policy idea, but in terms of actually getting it into working practice, it really isn't going to work.
We're going to have to keep talking about this because they're now going into overtime.
Don't they just go for an advertising break, just being American football? I mean, time is spent playing.
I didn't even have to know the score to know that, because I saw Ben go.
The thing is with the all the dead space. Yes, I fully admit it's a problem in most games, but you get in a game like this where unbelievably tense. Yeah. I mean, it's like
it's exciting.
It's same with baseball. I mean, I personally am not a huge baseball fan, but when you get to the postseason, it's just like every pitch has so much weight on it.
Yeah, this is exciting.
The stress.
The anticipation.
We'll let you continue to watch.
No, it's fine.
Bo Jackson has now crossed the.
I just think it's one of those. I was going to make a smart comment on my camera, but you're right. I'm totally distracted.
Yeah, go ahead. Pay attention. It's more important. The game's more important. It's crazy.
The only thing I would say is just like we, and I've written about this previously, is I think like there's some aspect of we in tech, you know, like it's clearly these people have no idea how this works. I mean, because you can't, you know, it's so obvious to us that if you put in a backdoor for law enforcement, you're by definition putting in a backdoor for everyone else in the world. And that clearly, or at least it seems to be clearly, doesn't resonate or doesn't make sense to people. And I mean, at some point, part of it has to be beyond just like going nuts about this stuff, actually like trying to help people understand like how this stuff works.
Cory Doctorow wrote on Boing Boing, what David Cameron just proposed would endanger every Briton and destroy the IT industry. Yep. He says if they understood the technology, they'd be shocked to their boots that this, and he gives actually a list of why this is a terrible idea. He says Cameron is proposing, first, all Britain's communications must be easy for criminals, voyeurs, and foreign spies to intercept. Because if you put a back door in.
Well, I mean, particularly if you put a back door in and you tell people you're putting a back door in it, it's going to be like the sort of, you know, the Manhattan Project to find this back door, exploit it, and, you know, the whole thing's toast. It's a ridiculous prospect.
It's worse than that, too, because if you think about the incentives and what the addressable market is, to use like business terms, like for the government, they are trying to prevent something from not happening, which is already kind of problematic from an incentive perspective and a challenge perspective. And two, they're looking for the proverbial needle in the haystack. If you're a criminal just looking to skim off credit card details or whatever, or personal information, or whatever it might be, and like the world is your oyster now. You can attack everyone. And not only that, but there's a very high incentive from a monetary perspective to do so. So like almost by definition, there's going to be way more break-ins and successful ones by their criteria, by and I'm not talking about like terrorist bad guys, just run-of-the-mill bad guys.
Or voyeurs, people who want to snoop.
Mm-hmm. No, totally. And so like just from a pure kind of incentive and like theory perspective, it's clearly going to fall very heavily on the vast majority of people that aren't even involved. And yeah. We haven't talked about the most obvious thing, which is like how many people have died of terrorism in the last 10, 15 years and how many people have died from car accidents or alcohol or all this sort of stuff. It's just it's a total lack of perspective that is gets back to kind of more fundamental questions about like society and like what motivates people and like what's the incentive here and who's really benefiting.
We should point out that the ministers and parliament have encryption that it has no back door.
Oh yes.
So there's no issue.
No. I mean,
for them.
Yes, if you look through the number of people who are actually using PGP and standard encryption techniques, they're all using them. That's fine. But, you know, if it goes to the general populace, then things could get rowdy.
Well, then you have to go to Apple and say messages has to either have a back door or you're going to have to leave your iPhone at the border.
Exactly.
You're going to have to go to Microsoft and say BitLocker has to have a back door or no Windows sales in the UK. It's unenforceable. And clearly Cameron must know that. What scares me a little bit is
the thing is, I've got a worrying feeling that he doesn't.
That's worse.
He came up with this idea and thought, right, okay, that'll show I'm tough on cyber crime, as he likes to call it. But I mean, the fact is, if GCHQ, which is our equivalent of the NSA, wanted to get your encryption keys, they could do it either by physically breaking into your house and getting
it. Give me your private keys, dude.
Or by hacking your system. So there's no real need for this.
Yeah.
But, I mean, GCHQ are pretty damn good at this.
Here's what scares me, because Cameron is in the United States meeting with Obama, and he and the president had a press conference 2 days ago in which it sounded like Obama was sympathetic.
Yeah, I read that, and I was just like, wow, that's...
He said, we're still going to have to find ways to make sure that if an Al-Qaeda affiliate is operating in Great Britain or the U.S., that we could try to prevent real tragedies. I think the companies, he's talking about the technology companies, want to see that as well. They're patriots. They have families they want to see protected. He does mention that there are technical issues.
Does he actually say think of the children, or is that a little too cliche?
He practically says think of the children. Think of the women and children.
We've had this ever since, for the last year or so, law enforcement, the director of the FBI is saying it would stop us from, from rescuing kidnapped children.
It is, to be fair, it isn't Cameron invented this. James Comey, the director of FBI, called for it a couple of months ago. Yep. And frankly, the FBI has been calling for this for decades.
But I mean, I was going to say, we were fighting this battle decades ago with the initial crypto battles, and we thought we'd won it, but they keep on coming back with this. And it's just... Designing good crypto is hard enough. Designing good crypto with a backdoor that no one else can exploit, just forget about it. Yeah. It's never going to happen.
So it's impossible. It's literally impossible.
Is it safe then to say, based on all of this, and I'll ask Serenity, give her a chance, that this is just politics and no one really intends for such a thing to happen?
I think yes and no. I mean, on one hand, you do definitely have both the president and the prime minister basically probably having a certain amount of pressure from security agencies and from, national security basically saying, hey, if you put your voice behind it, this will mean a lot more, it's more weight. Maybe the public is more receptive than the big, mean, overarching security agencies being like, we really need this. But the fact of the matter is, the lack of understanding which Ben mentioned, is the real danger here, where I really don't think of the majority of people on the Hill in D.C. and not in Britain or Europe either really have any good idea of just how ridiculous trying to put a backdoor is into a high crypto system. It's just it's baffling to me. And like, it just doesn't work.
What's fascinating is at the same time, and the Guardian had this story, there was 5 years ago a secret report on cybersecurity from the United States, I think it was the DOD, mm-hmm. in which it said that strong encryption is necessary to protect the United States. Yeah.
The FBI had that on their website up until 2011.
And they thought,
take
that down.
Well, this is the question they said about that these companies ought to be patriotic.
To me, that's scary.
Last refuge of the scoundrel.
Yes.
Yeah.
They have families.
There's a lot to unpack there. For one, these companies are all serving people all around the world. And there's obviously an implicit, valuing of some countries' lives over others. And as someone who lives abroad and is married to someone who is not a U.S. national, that certainly is frustrating to hear, although it's obviously common sentiment. The other thing, though, is if they're talking about, even if they are protecting about protecting citizens, this is making, as Cory Doctorow wrote in the piece you noted, this is making citizens less safe. If we're going to get all cold and analytical about this, if you take the kind of expected value of a terrorist attack, like the minute percentage that's going to happen and the chance that you or someone, any of your loved ones, are going to die in that terrorist attack, and compare that to the expected loss per person of having bad encryption or these quote unquote back doors, then the reality is you are hurting people. And so you ask, is this politics or is this a knowledge? I think it's probably both. I suspect, like Serenity said, it's not really understanding how this works and that you're asking for a unicorn here. But it also is that, and this is endemic in our politics, is that terrorist attacks are scary. Standing up against them is brave. And it's easy. It's easy in that it doesn't really require meaningful sacrifices from a political perspective, even if it is hurting us in all these other ways. And it's all very frustrating, and it's frustrating in a small and big picture perspective.
Yeah, it's the same idea of calling for we need to be safe from all attacks. Okay, what are you, or we need to bring down the national debt. Okay, how? we'll just put in a back door. Yeah, that doesn't actually work. We'll do it. It's fine.
Well, let me be a little bit of a devil's advocate. I understand the technical issues here. Mm-hmm. It's hard to do, and it's very, very hard to do. But if the mandate, and the mandate certainly from our government has been, protect us, NSA, FBI, CIA, protect us.
Yeah.
Isn't it critical that there be some way? I mean, we know that the electronic monitoring of communications has been mm-hmm. useful, does help protect us, does it not?
In terms of doing it on a mass scale, the jury is still very much out on that.
It's like torture.
Well, right? these are two
different questions, right? Like, I think the mass surveillance, yes, the jury is very much still out. But that's a completely different question than mandating the insertion of backdoors. Like, because
is it possible for these agencies to do their job if criminals and terrorists can communicate freely?
Criminals and terrorists are always going to be able to communicate.
They can't stop that.
Not really, no, without banning telephone, mail, and access to the internet.
Right.
I mean, the fundamental problem is that mass surveillance brings you such a deluge of information that your chances of picking an actual terrorist conversation out of that.
But I'll give you an example, and maybe this is a spurious example, but after the attacks at Charlie Hebdo, mm-hmm. one of the things that we heard was, the NSA is now going to go back through this massive pool of information and try to make connections, because now we have the endpoint, and backtrack from the endpoint to prior communications, which they would not have had they not been collecting this information all along, figure out who planned this attack, who are co-conspirators, where other attacks may be coming from. Isn't that valuable information?
That
comes from the mass collection of data.
I mean, yes, but you're talking about going back after the event, so it's not exactly keeping us safe. What they should have been doing. I mean,
well, but it also, but it could be known. It could be keeping us safe going forward as well, because maybe you find out there are other co-conspirators. Maybe you find the ring.
These guys had been to Yemen and come back. They should have been on a watch list anyway.
They were on a watch list. Weren't a watch list. The government had been watching them. They had recorded tons of their conversations or recorded or tracked or had the metadata or whatever it is. Like the issue additional, there was nothing that additional that tech company or anyone else could have done to prevent what happened in Paris, as tragic as it was. Like it was a fall down after the fact, which, by the way, was the same thing with 9/11. The fall down there was not in getting enough information to know what was going to happen. It was actually putting the pieces together and stopping it.
Yeah.
So it's another example of, I think this is an easy thing to ask for. It was easy from a political perspective, even though it is impossible. You can't put it.
It's easy to ask for, hard to do. Let me ask this question.
It's a lot harder to do good police work and to actually prevent this from happening. And this is a good way to distract attention from the fact that that didn't happen.
Just give us these technological means and somehow magically this will all work better.
Well, they're not asking for – sorry, Leo. They're not asking for the tech to help them sort through the data. They're asking for just the raw data.
It's collected
all.
And
we've seen – well, exactly. And we've seen already that just having a raw stream of data – I mean, it's like looking at the Twitter fire hose. Like, without good tools to sort and understand – I mean, you go back to World War II and the Enigma machine and everything like that.
But you kind of presume, Serenity, that they are working very hard on data mining techniques. And big data is – I mean, there's very smart people that – you know, a lot of this stuff is just stored presuming that we'll have some better data mining techniques in the future.
Yeah, but it's just interesting to me that they're calling – just specifically for that, where they're saying, oh, we're going to call for, you know, we're going to call for the thing that maybe we think the public will understand better and will make us look more sympathetic to the cause of freedom, rather than let's actually say, all right, we're going to put, you know, our money where our mouth is, right, and let's actively recruit at MIT and let's actively recruit, you know, and say,
I think
we're
looking
for people to make things better. Oh, I think they're doing it. You know, I think they're doing it. They're just not publicizing that. They're saying, you know, instead of getting all of the data, let's talk about getting, you know, let's get smarter algorithms and smarter people, and let's focus on making the system the best it possibly can be.
Lon Dog in the chat room says, well, then the bad guys just use paper mail, because in the U.S. anyway, that's strong protection there. Much better protection for paper mail than there is for data.
Well, I mean, David Cameron said, oh, we've always had the ability to read your mail.
But
they've had the ability to open the mail, but if you're writing an encryption to someone else, they've still got to break the encryption in the first place. Right. So they're kind of asking for a free pass on this.
Let me ask this, and maybe you're so close to China, you might know, Ben. Is there any country in the world currently effectively pursuing this strategy? Backdoors and encryption? Nobody's doing it. I mean, you've got some of the most oppressive regimes in the world. I'm sure China would love to do this. They can't. They're not doing it, are they?
Well, I mean, that's a complicated question.
I don't want to get you in trouble. And by the way, you can pay attention now, as you know. The game is over, but don't say who won.
Yeah, well, I will try to keep the glum look off my face. This is a positive, I think, for the U.S. is the fact that we're even having this conversation. I was actually going to say something similar, you know, along these lines, is, you know, the relative freedom we have on the net or anywhere else is light years ahead of a place like China, where everything is tracked, everything is looked into. There's a, you know, and the other issue is because these companies are based in the U.S., because our technology industry is so strong, that's where the pressure can be applied. I mean, if there are services that don't comply, it's very questionable. If there are services that don't comply with China, China can just ban them. They certainly, you know, they've obviously banned Google, they've banned Twitter, they've banned Facebook, they've banned other messaging services like Line, for example. And then when it comes to ones that do work there, like say WeChat, it's kind of assumed among everyone that lives there that the government is tracking everything on there. So, I mean, relatively speaking, if you compare us to somewhere like China, our freedoms are still far ahead, and the government is being far more egregious in violating, you know, whatever privacy you may or may not have. So in that, I mean, I guess everything is relative.
What is the sense? I know, Ian, you live here now, but... Mm-hmm. Sometimes I feel like GCHQ is worse than the NSA.
It's a subject of some debate. It's got to be said. I mean, the two work very closely hand in hand. GCHQ, however, hasn't faced the publicity problems that the NSA has.
There was no Edward Snowden.
There was no Edward Snowden, and they've just had a parliamentary inquiry into mass surveillance, and GCHQ were cleared. Completely, of everything they were doing was entirely within the law.
Same thing. The CIA did an internal investigation of the CIA spooks who broke into Congress's computers and said, "Oh no, they're okay."
I know.
It's okay, don't worry about
everyone
it.
Says the Americans don't get irony, and you did it beautifully that day.
Beautiful irony. Oh no, we did an internal investigation. There's nothing to see here. Move along.
I mean, GCHQ have a long record of doing this sort of stuff, of phone monitoring, of opening people's mail and the whole thing.
But I have said this again and again, and I really feel strongly that probably most of them, if not all of them, are patriots and do want to do the right thing and protect people from terrorist attacks.
Well, this is the patriot issue is a very challenging one, because the reality is that these revelations, particularly the Snowden revelations, have hurt U.S. tech companies, full stop. And we're only just now seeing that hurt manifest itself, because lots of countries, including countries like Brazil, but particularly countries like China, undertook significant efforts to extricate themselves from dependence on U.S. tech companies,
right,
in order to avoid this. I think one company in particular that's been hurt or will continue to be hurt is a company like Cisco, for example, which you don't really think about, but China is well underway and has been accelerated by the Snowden revelations to having their entire infrastructure be completely homegrown, and that's literally dollars and cents that are not flowing into the U.S. They're not flowing into the U.S. economy, and that's just one example of many where this has hurt the U.S. and has hurt U.S. tech companies. So it's a little rich for the U.S. to be. The reality is it is U.S. tech companies that have borne the greatest cost of the Snowden revelations to date. And it's a little rich at that kind of, they're going back to the well, as it were. And so the whole patriotic question is certainly a little fraught. You can make, I know people make the argument that these U.S. companies were established and thrived because of, being in the U.S. and the environment there and all that sort of thing. At the same time, their customers, in many cases, a majority of their customers are not in the U.S. And there's a lot of tension here. So I don't think it's any company's charter to further a particular country. And so there's a lot of tension there for companies as well.
Can we then safely conclude this by saying, enforcing this is a non-starter, but politically as well as technically, but
no, politically politically it's a great idea. I mean,
I think Congress would be reluctant, and I'm sure Parliament would be reluctant to pass a bill that would not only be technically unenforceable, but would be flouted so widely, that it would become a joke. I mean,
they have done it before.
Well, I didn't know you were such an optimist.
I try to be.
But yeah, I mean, the UK government has done this before. They instituted their famous, they didn't call it this, but a porn filter across the entire country.
Yeah, that's
right. So that if you wanted to receive an unfiltered internet stream, then you had to actually opt in and it was seen as going to your telecommunications provider.
How is that going?
To be honest, I think about just under 15% of people have opted out and said, no, I don't want anything naughty on my screen.
Who would want something
when they've actually implemented the ban, they blocked perfectly normal sites,
of course,
which were false positives. And it's easy enough to get around with a VPN. And it, to be honest, it's just, it keeps a certain section of the Conservative Party populace happy. And it's widely ignored by everyone else.
Yeah.
The danger with this is if they actually tried to enforce it, as has been said, it would destroy the IT industry in the UK. It would mean nobody would want to sell us products because they'd have to do so much to them in order to make them compliant. It's just, it's like I say, it's one of those things that sounds great, but actually to do it, I think wiser heads will prevail.
I believe so too. Although I get a lot of email and a lot of tweets from people who say, oh, you're like you did, Ben. Oh, you're an optimist, Leo. They'll pass this in a heartbeat. I feel like that's a risky business.
Yeah.
Put yourself in a very difficult situation with regards to the rest of the world.
I mean, UK is 60 million people. Who's really going to change the world?
Apple just says, okay, fine, you don't want iPhones, no problem.
Yeah.
Well, it's encouraging U.S. tech companies to venture elsewhere and say, oh, yeah, this is going to be a problem. Yeah, not so much.
Although I have to say, I mean, Google got out of China for about 5 minutes. I mean, these companies, they're not great at, kind of being.
They need money.
They go for the money. They're not.
They're businesses.
It's a business.
Yeah.
Let's take a break. Serenity Caldwell's here from iMore.com. Great to have you, as always. From The Register, Ian Thompson. First time on the show. Indeed. So nice to have you. TheRegister.co.uk or at Ian, I-A-I-N Thompson. Nope. Extra letter in the Ian, no P in the Thompson.
Yeah, I know. My parents, we've had words.
And then Ben Thompson, who does have a P, from Stratechery, Stratechery.com. A great panel. And Ben's just going to dry his eyes for a moment and compose himself. We were at the...
I'm actually grateful. One of the things, I first moved to Taiwan in 2003. I was here for 6 years, went back to the U.S., came back. But
are you from Wisconsin? Is that why you're...
Yes, I'm from Wisconsin. I was a sports nut when I came. And kind of I had no choice but to kind of lay off a little bit. And then I went
sumo,
back.
The sumo, I don't know. What is the big sport?
No, there's no sumo here. baseball and basketball are both pretty popular. Okay. But there's also stuff like, ping pong and pool. But in general, it's less of a sporting culture. Right. I think it was good for me personally to kind of have forced sobriety, as it were, when it comes to sports.
There is a tech angle here. I'm watching them receive the trophy for the NFC Championship, and lo and behold, there's Paul Allen, who owns the Seahawks, former Microsoft partner and billionaire. There he is talking right now.
Owner of the Yellow Submarine.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, Paul Allen, who also owned Tech TV and sold us to the highest bidder down the river. strangest person I've ever met. Very odd. He also owns the Portland Trailblazers. So
yes,
but I think if you've got unlimited funds, owning a sporting team is probably fun.
Hey, it's working.
Oh, I would totally buy a team if I had. Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah,
it's one of those things in your portfolio.
Let's form a coalition, the four of us, and we'll just buy. Who should we get? There's got to be a soccer club in the
Oakland Raiders.
The Oakland Raiders are going cheap right now. Absolutely,
we can buy a bleacher
seat. Sponsor my roller derby team.
Let's buy the Jets. Actually, I'm going to buy a mattress from Casper.com. Yes, Casper, the online retailer premium mattresses for a fraction of the price. We have a couple of Caspers. I got one at home. In fact, you have the video of me opening my Casper box. And then I liked it so much, I got one for my son in college. Casper saves you money by selling you mattresses over the internet. Now, you might say, well, wait a minute. That's no good. How am I going to get it? Well, it comes in a nice box. This is a queen-size mattress in a box. You know, it's smaller than maybe a port, one of those little college refrigerators. You take it out, you open it up, and it becomes a beautiful, luxurious queen-size mattress. Now you may say, well, okay, that's fine, Leo. You can get it to me, but what if I don't like it? Well, this is really cool. So much better than just kind of lying on a mattress in a showroom for 5 minutes. You have 100 days. 100 days to try your beautiful, comfortable Casper mattress. If for any reason you don't like it, they'll take it back. They make it easy to return. It's completely risk-free. Free delivery.
I think this will be blocked by the UK porn filters, by the way.
Right.
It's kind of sensual in a deeply disturbing way.
Yeah. It's sensual. I loved it. I love my Casper. They're watching the video of me just falling blissfully into my Casper. The dog liked it too. Free delivery, painless returns with a 100-day period. And they're made in the USA. They're really wonderful. Lisa liked it too. Look at that. She just fell right asleep. Latex and memory foam come together to give you kind of the best of both. A mattress with just the right sink and just the right bounce, just the right firmness and support, but just the right comfort. I can't describe it. You've got to get it. $500 for a twin, $950 for a king size. That's a great price compared to what a mattress in the mattress store is going to cost you. And you'll save an additional $50 by going to Casper.com/twit. Just use the promo code TWIT and save $50 on your Casper purchase. Casper, Casper.com/twit, promo code twit. It is a great night's sleep. We love our Casper. I think maybe more important than the encryption issue is the issue of cyber warfare. We've kind of stopped talking about Sony and whether North Korea was involved or not. But it,
either way, it's clear that we are about to enter a digital arms race. And in fact, the latest Snowden leaks from Der Spiegel talk about how the NSA is arming for future digital wars.
Arming, but not preparing for defense.
Well, it's so hard to prepare for defense.
And it's not as sexy.
It's not as sexy as attacking.
No, it's worse than not preparing for defense. We are actively weakening our defenses. This is directly correlated to the last thing we just talked about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they call them D weapons. What is the D? Data?
It's
digital?
Giving them the date. No, no.
And by the way, the Geneva Convention, even though the Geneva Convention blocks A, B, and C weapons, atomic, biological, and chemical weapons, there's no mention of D weapons because they didn't know. What there's D weapons?
But there's no mention of flying laser cannons either. Yeah. Does that mean we can do those now?
So you can do it.
Laser-equipped sharks. Yes. Yeah.
Marshall McLuhan wrote about this in 1970. World War III is a guerrilla information war with no division between military and civilian participation. In 1970, McLuhan said that. And it's absolutely part of it. Now, we're right now in phase zero, which is the surveillance phase.
Well, it's going to get very busy very quickly. There's already been the first reports of somebody at ISIS trying to use this to track down on opponents.
Is that the problem? Is that it escalates? I mean, this is why you have the Geneva Accords, is that one side uses chemical, the other side does, and then it becomes untenable.
I think I'm not sure it's a direct correlation so much as it's just that stuff becomes, you know, it's become so cheap and easy to use. I mean, you can buy off-the-shelf malware for a couple hundred bucks on a black forum right now. And if you can use that to keep track of your political opponents or the people you're trying to rule over, it's all the defenses are so unsophisticated that pretty much anything can get through. And now that, you know, it's been kicked off, we've seen this work in Stuxnet, everyone else is now saying, right, we've got to get in the game. I mean, earlier this week, the Danish government said that it was going to spend $73 million developing a cyber attack and defense system. The Danes, I mean, no one's invaded them since the Germans. They took them over in 8 hours. I mean, but the Danes can now punch at their weight because it's digital
it's
and everyone.
Digital. Yeah. All you need is a university, some CS graduates. According to these documents from Edward Snowden, seen exclusively by Der Spiegel, the NSA is planning for the war of the future in which the internet will play a critical role with the aim of being able to use the net to paralyze computer networks and, by doing so, potentially all the infrastructure, including power and water supplies, factories, airports, the flow of money. The U.S. Army, Navy, Marines, and Air Force already have their own cyber forces, but the NSA is taking the lead. Now, as with much of the Snowden material, it's not completely up to date, but for the 2013 secret intelligence budget, the NSA projected it would need about $1 billion to dedicate to this computer network attack operations.
You put it in the context of that kind of A, B, C, D thing previously, but this is a difference of type. And it's a problem in particular for the United States, most of all. And the reason is when it comes to digital warfare, everyone, I think Ian was referring to this, everyone's on the same starting position. Like there's no inherent advantage to having a big military. There's no inherent advantage to having a large industrial base.
It's easy.
It's cheap and it scales. And in fact, the U.S. is probably in a worse position because we have the largest, the most things to attack.
Exactly.
So... It's completely flipped on its head, where the asymmetric actor, the one that's hard and small and hard to catch, can inflict a lot of damage,
it's
and the one that's large is easier to be attacked.
That's the old tenet of guerrilla warfare. It's easy in a guerrilla war, and this is why Vietnam was so difficult. It's the mobile person who understands the terrain better.
You can disappear in and out of sight and do an enormous amount of damage.
So it's analogous to guerrilla warfare.
Yeah, well, the skills and what's needed don't really cost money.
Right.
Like, and that.
Well, I just want to tell Denmark right now, not on my watch, Denmark, not on my watch. So get this.
They'll have you drinking Heineken before you know it. And
all downhill from there.
It would be so bad. A little Tuborg here. Politrain. This is a project funded by the Tailored Access Operations, or TAO, which is a group of the NSA, the digital snipers, the Der Spiegel
calls them, are looking for interns. Now, listen up, kids, because this would be a great internship. They're looking for people who are into breaking things. Potential interns are also told that research into third-party computers might include plans to, quote, remotely degrade or destroy opponent computers, routers, servers, and network-enabled devices by attacking the hardware. There is a program called Passionate Polka that will allow you to remotely brick network cards, always handy. Program like Berserker that implants persistent backdoors and parasitic drivers. Piece of software called Barnfire that would erase the BIOS on a brand of servers that act as a backbone to many rival governments. The intern's tasks, in case you're interested, might also include remotely destroying the functionality of hard drives. Ultimately, the goal of the internship program was developing an attacker's mindset. This listing is 8 years old. But yeah, you got to figure they found some people.
Well, they recruit at Black Hat and DEF CON each year. Yeah. It's always interesting to see the NSA stand there and just like, okay. And you talk to people who are attending the show, and they're like, well, on the one hand, you get access to all this really cool
technology.
And on the other hand, you might blacken your soul a bit. But on the other, you know, I mean, Snowden was working in Hawaii on a six-figure salary. I mean, it's got to be pulling some people in.
Exactly. So starts with surveillance. That's phase zero. The aim of the surveillance to detect vulnerabilities in enemy systems. So that's going on right now, looking around, snooping around. Kind of like what happened in the spring at Sony Pictures Entertainment. The first break-in was easily ignored because nothing seemed to go wrong. At that point, the bad guys, whether from North Korea or wherever else, were able to wander the network, get passwords, get logins. And it wasn't till the fall that the actual secondary attack, phase three.
So it's a battle. You've got the reconnaissance. You've got
reconnaissance.
Mapping out battle plans. And then, whoosh, you're in.
So phase two, and stealth. So go ahead, Serenity.
Oh, no, I was saying then you take everything.
You take it all?
Yeah.
Stealthy implants in phase two get placed to infiltrate enemy systems, then allowing permanent access. This is exactly what happened at SPE. This is the Sony hack. Then phase three, a phase headed by the word dominate in the documents, control/destroy critical systems and networks at will through pre-positioned accesses laid in phase zero. Critical infrastructure is anything considered by the agency to be important in keeping society running. So you go after power plants, you go after communications, you go after transportation.
Some very interesting research on sewage systems. You actually stop a sewage system, you can make a city uninhabitable within a matter of weeks. It's amazing what these people...
And these are very vulnerable targets. I mean, we know this. I mean, our power grid, many of the power companies in the United States are run by not governments, but third parties franchised by the government.
They're using software that's
old technology,
1960s and 70s.
Windows XP machines sitting unprotected on the internet.
Oh, no, it's worse. This is Windows 3.1. You know what I mean? It's
actually, that would be safer because it's so... That can't do anything. It's just a shell.
The problem with security in general, and if there's a silver line to the Sony hack, it's this, is security is successful security is something not happening. And that's really hard to attach a value to. Whereas the cost of having effective security is quite expensive.
Yeah.
And so you talked about companies being money-making enterprises. You look at the balance sheet, and on one side, there's this huge expense to have security. And the other side, what is countering that? How do you put a price on not being hacked? There was a fascinating article from like 7 or 8 years ago with the head of Sony Pictures Security, actually, basically saying that we're not going to spend too much. Like, what's the point of spending $10 million or something? In retrospect, ridiculously small amount of some money. He's like, you have to. It's all a balancing risks and benefits, you know, like, is this really worth it? Should we take a chance? And in retrospect, he completely underestimated the damage that could be caused. And his approach, though, it's hilarious in retrospect, but it was very rational. And lots of companies take that approach. It's not a, we need to be secure. It's a, we need to balance the costs and benefits. The problem is the costs, I think, have been dramatically undervalued. And if there's one good thing that comes out of Sony, it's that people will start to properly evaluate just how much does it cost to be insecure, which will result in a lot more investment in security. Like, and that, if that does happen, that's the equation that's going to make it happen.
One of the things that we want to watch closely is this week's now, State of the Union speeches. A lot of interesting stuff going on. Actually, there's a bunch of stories around this, including the incredible social media strategy the Obama White House is using. They're going to give interviews to three YouTube stars. The president, because they realize fewer and fewer people are watching the State of the Union on TV. And I guess they've decided, oh, no, we want to get those 10-year-olds who watch a lot of YouTube, so that he's going to give interviews to three YouTube stars as part of this huge social media, Twitter, YouTube
thing. I should imagine Reddit will get on there as well.
Yeah, you know, I'm sure it will. He's going to be interviewed according to the LA Times.
Grumpy Cat.
Not a grumpy cat. Yeah, actually would be smart. A teen style guru, a video blogging nerd, and a green lipstick wearing comedian who says she's ready because she's been watching Veep.
Oh, great.
Oh, wow.
That's going to be some tough questions to ask. Yeah. So what's your favorite color?
Let me be an opposite voice here. I don't understand why we are here sitting so skeptical.
No, I think
it wasn't that long ago that it was the weird geeks on the internet with a podcast and a blog and a message board. That
they've skipped right back past the podcast. That's all. I'm just jealous.
That's reasonable.
Just gone right to YouTube.
But I do find it interesting how quickly many, you know, geeks and nerds or whatever term you want to use are so quick to turn around and mock and judge.
Here's why.
That are different than us.
Here's why. And by the way, this is, you know, the presidency has always been fairly astute. Nixon beat Humphrey in 68 because he brought in a lot of ad men. He'd learned his lesson from 1960 in the TV debate against Kennedy. And he said, all right, this isn't going to happen again. And I'm going to market myself as a product like Tide or Coke. And I'm bringing in ad men. It was the first time that ad men arrived in the White House, and it was very successful. And I think what's happened is the Obama White House is digitally literate, and very similarly, they say, well, look, we've got to go to the people where they are. I do have to say there's nothing wrong with that. There is one concern, which is that you might tend to pick people who aren't going to ask tough questions, that you might say, we're going to end around the critics, the tough, informed reporters by going to people who are just, you know, lifestyle reporters. That's not an unusual strategy. That's why Bill Clinton played the saxophone. Was it on Leno?
Something. Because
what was it? It's like MTV.
I believe it was on MTV. Yeah, I can't remember which.
That's where you go. Because nobody on MTV is going to ask him hard questions, but he's going to play the sax and everybody's going to go, hey, he's cool. I'd like to have a beer with him.
Even with soft questions, I mean, I feel like being able to have the dialogue opened up to folks who aren't politically literate is really important. If there are young kids and, you know, guys and girls who are watching YouTube tutorials on makeup or whatever, and that's their first exposure to actually being able to listen to what the president has to say outside of, like, maybe catching half of a blog post somewhere. Right. Like, they may not be the toughest questions you might get from the room. But then again, I mean, the room's filtered anyway. So it's one of those things where I feel like exposure in this case, especially, I mean, the graph of, like, young Americans who are interested in politics and interested in participating and making their voice heard, you know, goes up and down and up and down. And there has been some decline since, you know, in 2012 and going on. And I think keeping people under 30, keeping them in the public, you know, in public debate and being able to actually get energized to pay attention to the political sphere is really going to be key in the next 20 years, because they're going to be the generation.
You're absolutely right. I stand corrected. That's absolutely true. I hope they will ask the president about law. He's supposedly during the State of the Union going to propose new laws against hacking, which would make it a felony to intentionally access unauthorized information, even if it's just a link on Twitter.
Yeah.
And this is a post on Errata Security by Robert Graham, who tweeted, ha ha, New York Times accidentally posted their employee database to their website. And then he said, and if you click on this link, you're committing a felony, or you would be under this new regime.
It's not as though that sentences are particularly light for hackers as it is.
Anyway,
I mean, yeah. They can manage to get 35 years for Aaron Schwartz to face. Then, you know, I don't think they really need to be upping those sentences that much more. And some of the things they're talking about, I mean, we've got a real problem now. And the first generation of people who bought their music on iTunes are getting ready to die. And when that happens,
wait a minute.
Who gets hold of the iTunes password?
Stop it!
Well, no, I mean, technically, you don't own that music.
No,
but
that's
most
right.
people are planning to do Kindle is books. Leave their passwords to the next generation. But technically, that would be illegal.
Right.
You know, it's.
You don't actually own those. That's your account.
But, you know, under these charges, then sharing passwords in that way could be construed in such a way as to be a big criminal offense.
One big concern is that he will propose upgrading hacking to a racketeering offense. And as you know, these RICO rules were made to help the Department of Justice fight organized crime. And they've been used widely to enrich police departments who just grab houses or boats or whatever. Well, I think you were hanging out with a bad guy. You could be guilty of being a hacker by just acting like a hacker. For instance, hanging out in an IRC chat room, giving advice to people could make you a member of a criminal enterprise, which means the FBI could confiscate all your assets without ever charging you with a crime.
Mm-hmm.
He says, if you clicked on that Twitter link, and you think you can defend yourself in court, prosecutors can still use the 20-year sentence of a racketeering charge in order to force you to plea bargain down to a 1-year sentence for hacking. There's some real issues about this. This is a good article to read. I hope the YouTubers who interview the president get a chance to read this and ask him some good questions.
But it comes back to the same problem of politics, as you and Ben were saying, in that politically this sounds great. Let's get tough on hackers.
A war on hackers? Who's against that?
In practice, you know, the whole thing is A, pointless, and B, actively counterproductive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, if you look at it also...
Go ahead, Serenity. Ben.
No, go ahead, Serenity.
So if you look at it from a realistic point of view, like there are things that we could be making laws against if we wanted to really. We could be focusing on doxing. We could be focusing on, you know, all of the things that are actually physically harmful to people day to day, rather than focus on the big picture of the nebulous, you know, the hacking menace and But there are still, you know, you see all the stuff, of course, that's going on with Gamergate the last 6-9 months now, and the fact that it's still so difficult to get any, you know, to get sentencing for threats on the internet or any, you know, like there are different kinds of problems of, you know, internet crime and internet hacking that haven't been addressed at all by the Justice Department, and that they seem to be not necessarily turning a blind eye to, but not being able to adequately address, and nor are the lower courts. So it's one of those things. It's like, if you want to make new laws and you want them to be hacking focused, there are options and topics that you could focus on.
Actually, the UK has arrested another guy in conjunction with those Christmas Day DDoSes on Xbox Live and the PlayStation Network, an 18-year-old arrested near Liverpool. He was also accused of swatting via Skype. So who knew you could Skype in from the UK and get somebody swatted in the United States?
There was a big discussion about this at DEFCON last year, and it's surprisingly easy, disturbingly easy to do, because the actual security on the systems that alert the SWAT teams is quite simple to spoof if you know how to do it. But another one of my countrymen getting arrested. It's such a proud week for us.
That's the two now Lizard Squad members in the UK. A 22-year-old was arrested in London at the end of last month. And a Finnish man has been interrogated, 17-year-old, over the attacks.
Yeah, well, to be honest, it's dark in Finland. There's not a lot else to do. Probably got a bit drunk. I thought, yeah, hey.
Dude, you can hack Sony, but do not mess with our PlayStation Network. Do not. Or the full wrath of the United States and England will come down upon thine head. Let's take a break. Got a great panel here. Ian, it's nice to have you. I hope you'll come
back.
Thank
you very much, me. Certainly.
Yeah. You had a nice posh accent to the mix, and I love the snark from the Register. What is your beat at the Register.co?
I cover mainly security, science, and a little bit of politics.
You're here on exactly the right day.
Works for me.
And yeah. I will note that he is using a Chromebook, not just any Chromebook, but a Chromebook Pixel as his laptop. Day-to-day?
No, this is my just internet email carry around, which is nice and light.
I don't care if you lose it, computer.
Ultimately, no, not that much. I mean, it would be, I do like it, don't get me wrong, but, you know, I've got a proper system back home with decently locked down, and, yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
I love the Pixel.
I do too. I use it.
Almost every Shecky article is written on it.
That's my breakfast computer.
Yeah. The one thing I hate about it is without an internet access, it's a very expensive paperweight.
But a beautiful one.
What computer isn't, though?
Well, I don't know. I mean,
I feel like it's like a security blanket. The reality is if I don't have internet, I'm not sitting around like creating like collages in Photoshop or something.
That's a good point.
I mean, know, but you can
play a game on my
phone. It's just a fancy.
You can at least fire up a game and just, you know, sort of blast away half an hour. But yes, it's.
One reason it's good to be in studio, Ian, is we have snacks.
Ooh, sweet.
It's snack time. Well, they could be sweet. They could be savory. They could be spicy.
I would say America, they're probably going to be sweet. But yes.
Wait a minute. Sea salt pop pops. Sea salted popcorn kernels. That sounds pretty good. Whole corn, soybean or sunflower oil, and sea salt. That's it. These are Nature Box, see. These are not your average go to the vending machine, get a candy bar snacks. These are the kinds of snacks you want to have available. Delicious, nutritionist design snacks like honey Dijon pretzels.
Wow. Ooh,
yeah. All right. Fancy. You want sweet? We got sweet blueberry almonds because you get the antioxidants of the almonds along with the sweet that your mouth needs. I have to say Nature Box is awesome. Here's coffee kettle popcorn. Now, the cool thing about this, these are on resealable bags, so they lock back up. And what's really great is they'll deliver these to your door every month. Hundreds of delicious nutritionist-approved snacks, never any artificial flavors, colors, or sweeteners, 0 grams trans fats, no HFCs, high fructose corn syrup. And if you want snacks with bold flavors, my friends, you will get them like chocolate banana chips, Kung Pao pretzels. You'd probably like those there. I see your pictures on Instagram, Ben. Delicious meals in Taipei. Little Kung Pao pretzel, Or a lemon pucker pistachio Nature Box. You can even get snacks that are vegan, gluten-free. They've got them all. NatureBox.com. Here's the deal. I'm going to get you a complimentary sample box right now. If you go to naturebox.com/twit, you'll get 5 snacks, get an idea of the tastes available. Just pay $2 for shipping. That's it. NatureBox.com/twit. Stay full. Stay strong. Start snacking smarter. Which one do you want? You can have any of them.
I'll go for the sea salt, actually.
Really? You like that?
Yeah. I mean, the coffee looks interesting, but I'm allergic to coffee, which is a real pain in it.
Here you go. Sea salt sun crunch.
Okay.
That's another one. You can choose. Pop-ups.
Ooh, I'll go for that. Yeah.
Or sweet blueberry almonds.
I'm more of a savory chap myself.
See, it's tough. It's tough, isn't it?
I do like the sunflower. So crackling into the microphone.
I'd send these out to you, Serenity, if I could.
I know. Of all the days to be on the East Coast.
Good. They're awfully good. Is it snowing in Boston?
It is not, but there is snow on the ground.
Ay.
Yeah, but all winter.
How cold does it get in Taipei? Are you in Taipei? I'm just assuming that, Ben.
Yep, I'm in Taipei.
Okay. Do you get snow?
No, it will snow on the top of the very highest mountains,
right.
Like maybe once every couple of years.
Right.
So, it gets down to, it's in the coldest times are probably about in the 50s, which doesn't sound bad, but the problem is it's very chilly because it's rainy.
Yeah,
and there's no heat or no insulation, so inside your house is just as cold as outside your house. So it's actually a bit miserable, but it doesn't last that long. And I will definitely take it over it being like 0 degrees and snowy on the ground. So I'm by no means complaining.
Where do I see those great? Is it Monk Bent on Instagram? Those pictures of that amazing stuff you get to eat.
Oh, I'm jealous.
I know. Look at this.
Ooh, good scotch as well.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Oh. This is just torture. I haven't.
Pure malt Nika whiskey. 21
year
old.
That's a Japanese one. That's quite good.
Ooh. Yeah, Monk Bent is Ben's handle on Twitter and on Instagram. And if you want to. Is that a chicken foot you're actually biting into there?
It is a chicken foot.
Oh.
Tasty?
It is good. I'm not some people are just massive fans. I'm not gonna go out on that way for it, but it's good.
Crispy?
No, it's very soft. It's very soft. That's actually why I don't like it as much. I find it too soft.
I was gonna say, surely if you're eating chicken's feet, that's a sign that somebody else has stolen the rest of the chicken. I mean, there's just like,
it's all that's left.
We had got some barbecue last night where one of the best things is chicken butt. Where you have a skewer and you have like 4 or 5 of them right on there.
Oh, wow.
Think about it. It's very muscular. It's good. It's really good.
I'm trying really hard. So
there's a tiny bit of gristle in there, which is a little disturbing.
Oh, suddenly I'm not hungry.
Yeah. Way to kill
those pop pops away.
Then.
Yeah. Save them for later. Ooh. Let's see. You were at CES, Serenity. Did you see anything? We talked about it last week, of course. But did you see anything you really enjoyed, or were you stuck at that booth the whole time?
No, I actually got a fair amount of time to walk around Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. I was saying before the show, the big thing that I sort of had the takeaway of walking away of getting to try the Oculus Rift's new prototype, which is really, really impressive. And it makes me more and more excited for the eventual release. Maybe we'll see it this year, maybe. But it was really something spectacular. Like, people talk about seeing sort of next generation technology actually in action. And the Oculus, I mean, the headset I wore was still tethered, and I was confined to like a certain amount of space, and it was just a pre-roll demo. But even so, that was the first, like, that's the first technology that I've seen in a while at CES that really made me go, oh, man, we are actually, like, this could change a lot of things about the way that we game, about the way that we, you know, interact with people. It's a really cool system. They've done some amazing work.
So this is the Crescent Bay.
Crescent Bay prototype, yeah.
Okay, and we're, by the way, watching a video created by Tested. It's on their YouTube site of them using this. So what I have the original Oculus Rift.
The D2 model, is that right?
Whatever the Kickstarter thing was.
Yeah.
So what is different in here?
Well, for one thing, they've greatly improved in terms of the motion sickness, and the field of vision is much better.
Is the resolution higher? Because it was 720, I think.
I believe the resolution is slightly higher, or at least, I mean, to my eyes, it felt like full frame HD. But I'm not personally qualified to be able to be like, yes, it was this many pixels. But right. It's very immersive. And one of the great things about this prototype is that they've added in stereo sound.
So they have headphones on them.
Yeah, little tiny half speakers. You just put on when you put on the headset, and it really does. It absolutely immerses you. I mean, you talk about, you know, people filmmaking 101, the sound, good sound design, and good sound experience is the thing that makes or breaks you getting sucked into a movie. With the Oculus, having a stereo sound experience, both of the sound effects and the music that they chose for each segment, completely immersive. Absolutely. As I was saying before the show, there's one segment in the 6.5 minute Crescent Bay demo where you're standing on top of a building, an 80 story building, and you can hear the city. Like, you can hear all the whirs. You look up and you can hear a air balloon, like a Zeppelin, passing over by. You hear the traffic, the city noise, the rain. Like, it's incredible what they've been able to do. It really is.
I think sounds interesting.
It is.
Yeah.
It's an extra step onto the VR experience that I wasn't really expecting. And especially, this was my first time being able to play with an Oculus prototype. And I know, you know, they've been at CES the past couple of years, but I'd been taking a quick like CES break. And so when I saw that they were at the show this year, I kind of jumped at the chance to try it. But sound adds such an interesting additional experience to virtual reality. Because again, like, there's only so much that your eyes can trick you into believing. Like, I can stand on the edge of a virtual building, but without the sound, I still hear like the humming of my, you know, say my air conditioner or something.
Right.
If I was doing it in my room. You add speakers, you add headphones, and not only is it, you know, not only do you have background sound, but you have immersive sound. And I think it's the difference between, you know, a stereo sound system that you get in a theater and something that's actually being piped directly to your ears, that's encasing you almost fully in this world.
Wow. Yeah. And did you ask them how the Facebook relationship has been? Of course, because Facebook bought Oculus last year. And a lot of people were a little perturbed by that, the notion that somehow Mark Zuckerberg might steal the or steer the development.
Yeah, well, you know, go ahead.
I was going to say a lot of people who invested in the original Kickstarter weren't happy with that as well.
And yeah, me included.
But yeah, I mean, do you think they got their money's worth?
Yeah, you know.
Mark's got money to burn. He doesn't have to ask that question, right?
The thing that I think is really important for a bigger company sort of putting in development resources into Oculus, Facebook had me a little bit worried just because Facebook, you know, I mean, it's not exactly your first choice if you're saying, oh, a VR game development company.
Perfect, guys.
And then also with all of Facebook's, you know, myriad concerns. But I actually, it makes sense from me from a wider perspective. If you take away Oculus just being for video games and movies, right? And you consider it more of a world-reaching help, like general day-to-day help tool. You think about, there have been tons of books written about this over throughout the years, but I think about Ready Player One, and I think about the idea of, you know, people being able to have virtual classrooms who can't necessarily get to college and actually being able to interact with students. You think about retirees who maybe have some kind of disability that prevents them from getting outside the house and being able to put on a headset and interact with someone who may live, you know, down the street or 100 miles away in the same sort of recreational center, being able to talk to a therapist or something like that without having to, you know, to leave your house. I mean, yes, in some respects, this sounds maybe very antisocial, but for people who legitimately can't leave the house for one reason or another,
huge.
people with disabilities, yeah, autism, like anyone with...
I'm going to be in the nursing home in a couple of years. I want to be able to still go to Paris with my VR helmet.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that there are a lot of possibilities for virtual reality beyond your traditional, let's put it on and feel like we're really, you know, in an alien environment and shoot people. And I think that's what Facebook's really interested in is they're not looking at, I mean, Mark Zuckerberg, for all of his flaws, is a smart kid. He knows that, you know, the Facebook's current model, you know, scrolling and talking to friends and typing and all of that, that's not going to be around forever. And they need to figure out, all right, if we're really focused on the social experience, if that's our voice for the next 20, 30 years, how do we stay vital and how do we survive in the future and in this next, you know, generation of tech? And I really, you know, I think VR is definitely a potential solution. It's not perfect yet. But for a real version one, a shippable version one, I'm really, really impressed by Crescent Bay.
No question that Zuckerberg and Facebook are all in on this. In fact, Mark was in Colombia this week, and Reuters snagged an interview with him and found out that they're planning, there are listings for 54 new positions in the Oculus division alone. In fact, Facebook is, according to this exclusive story on Reuters, set to swell its ranks by as much as 14%, 1,200 new employees. And virtual reality is one of the key areas slated for growth.
Well, there's a really, I think, fundamental question here. First off, no, I haven't used Oculus. I don't think this would, when you hear what I say, I don't think it would change what I have to say, but I'll have that out there. From a gaming perspective, or from an experience perspective, or from some of the great examples that Serena just listed, things like, you know, going to a classroom or going on a trip, I think that it's the future. It's very compelling. But all those are destination sort of activities. They may be more immersive, they may be more there, but they're still. You are deciding to put in the very action of wearing one of these. You have to go get it and you have to put it on and then you go have an experience. And I think that there certainly is room for this. And we see that right now. We see amazing video game systems. We do see, traveling through things through the internet. Obviously, a lot of it sucks now because it's not fully immersive and it will be way better when virtual reality comes along. So from that perspective, I think it's interesting. Where I question Facebook in particular is when they bought it, Mark Zuckerberg said, and I'm quoting here, strategically, we want to start building the next major computing platform that will come after mobile. There are not many things that are candidates to be the next major computing platform. This is a long-term bet on the future of computing.
Right.
And that's where I'm a little more skeptical. And the reason I'm skeptical comes back to kind of just a fundamental philosophy I have about computers and about computing. And that is, I don't think that for most people, computers are a destination. Computers are a means to better live their life, to accomplish the things they want to accomplish, to talk to the people they want to talk to waste time they want to waste, whatever it might be. I think most people view computers as a tool, to steal Steve Jobs' words, as a bicycle for their mind. But the point, the point is still the mind. The point is still what right. you're doing. And so I think Oculus is interesting and will and absolutely has a future. But I see that future as being more of a additive destination type future, as opposed to the controlling feature in our day-to-day lives, which mobile very much is today.
Yeah, but Facebook kind of missed the boat on mobile initially, and I think they don't want to miss the boat on whatever's next. So I imagine it's more than one investment and more than
well,
one.
Well, which is a great way to assume bad decisions, because they have questionable incentives.
They have a lot of headroom, though. I mean, they can afford it.
No, which is fine. Again, I the technology itself is fine. I'm just skeptical on this is the future, and Facebook wanting it to be the future doesn't make it more right. likely to be the future.
Well, yeah. Here's what's really clear. There's two big trends, and you see them going on. You certainly see the movement of CPU power from a centralized position, the mainframe computer, farther and farther out in the periphery. The personal mm-hmm. computer was the first step, but the Internet of Things is kind of the most recent step, where chips are so small, so powerful, so low power that you can put them in almost anything. And now you see CPUs in almost anything. And the other trend is towards immersion. And this is not just for gaming, but for content of all kinds. The idea of going to a movie and having it be immersive, whether it's an IMAX screen or 3D, playing a game and having it surround you. But I think immersive can also doesn't just have to be consuming content. It could also be participating with content.
I disagree with you. I think you actually skipped what is the trend, if I may be so blunt.
Please do. And you're so good at this. That's why we read Stratechery every week.
The trend is to be more and more personal. Like, is to be more like, and yes, when you went from a mainframe, went to a PC, what was compelling about that was that it was accessible to more people.
Yeah.
And then from a desktop to a laptop, it was not just accessible to more people, but it was accessible in more places.
Right. Mobile
and
too.
That's what is so meaningful about mobile. It's not just, you say something like mobile first. Facebook is the best example. We're going to be mobile first. And they've done a fantastic job of executing and doing that.
Right.
But mobile first is not just about apps. It's not just about services. It's about how every single aspect of a person's life and every single business in the world is changed by the fact that people have a computer with them all the time. Like, and so you see everything from the way small businesses will market themselves, or the way that they'll do services, or the way that they'll reach customers or do orders. You go to a place like China, you pull out your mobile phone and you can go on like on WeChat, the chat map application. You can literally just order food from the dumping place down the street. You can order tickets, like all this stuff that people are announcing here in the US, like they're way ahead there. And part of it is because for so many people, the smartphone was their very first computer. And but what's key about this, and what makes the mobile so compelling, is that the smartphone goes with you into your actual life.
Right.
Like, and yes, there's an aspect of on the subway, I'm looking at my smartphone. Am I really present? But the fact of the matter is we're becoming more engaged with the real world, not less.
I like
that's actually my pitch for the Apple Watch, is the idea and connected technology in general, wearable computing, the idea that, not only do you have computers that you can put in your pocket, but contextual computers, computers that are smart enough to know what you want to do, when you want to do it, or sometimes even before you want to do it, where you're, Google Now is a little bit of a creepy version of this. And of course, there's that line to walk, right? Because a computer doesn't want to be, you don't want your service to be so intelligent and so predictive that it makes you feel unsettled about using it. But at the same time, having something that's keenly aware of what you like to do and, what you're interested in, and presenting you with the correct options, and something that you can communicate with constantly. My ideal my ideal future computer is something that's so, like a combination of something like a mobile tablet or a watch and a Kinect, where, you know, you have an ability, not even Minority Report style, but something where you've got the ability to create whatever you want, wherever you are. If I'm sitting on a subway, I can, you know, pull up a screen or a tablet and instantly start sketching whether or not I actually have a physical implementation in my hand. You know, that would be really, really cool. The idea that you can just pull things from wherever they're stored in your life. Now that may be super future talking, but we do have a variety of that already existing in our current technology. You know, on my phone, I can pull up almost every book I've ever bought digitally, which is most of the books that I have physically in this room as well. You know, I can pull up my social life. I can doodle. I can sketch. I can pull up files from my computer. I can pull up my computer screen. I can share with my media server. You know, we have all of these connections. It's just a matter of building the right tools that can actually help us interact day to day. And I agree with you, Ben. I don't think Oculus in its current form is something where it's, you know, snow crash like, where we're you know, going to be constantly using it all the time.
Metaverse. I want the metaverse.
Well, yes. I think what Leo was right was that there are two paths. I was probably more arguing with the one. Like, one is personal, and there's always been the diversionary path. We've gone to movie theaters. We've sat down to watch TV.
But isn't VR the more personal version of that? Like, when you're wearing an Oculus Rift, it's as personal as you can get.
No. The distinction is what is, as Serenity just laid out, what are ones that are a part of your life and which ones are destinations? I put Oculus in the destination category.
Well, you're not going to walk around with one on, one off.
Exactly. And well, that's compelling.
But maybe augmented reality or a heads-up display? Well, Maybe Google Glass?
The analog here, I think, is Microsoft, like, focusing on Xbox, for example. They've been relatively successful, but everyone thinks of the company's last 10 years as being a big problem because they missed mobile. Because mobile is way more important. And the reason mobile is more important is because mobile is a part of your life at all times. And Xbox is something you make an appointment with and you sit down and do. And I put Oculus in that category. I and perhaps I'm biased. I hope we don't have a future where it's like, what's the Pixar movie? Where they're up in outer space.
Wall-E.
Yeah, Wall-E.
No, I want Wall-E, and I can sip my soda and wear my visor. And
I mean, this is where Oculus are quite clear they're going with this, in that they're giving a presentation last year, and it's just, what we want is putting on sunglasses which give you the full virtual reality
and
augmented reality view. And they're quite clear it's 10, 15 years in the future. You need massive computational power. You need huge bandwidth. And you need the battery life to make it work.
Gosh, it doesn't feel like it's that far off.
I mean,
we've got Google.
I mean, 15 years isn't really that far away.
Well, it is for me. Like I said, I don't have much longer to live.
So, oh, Leo.
But it's like Demon. It's like in that great book, Demon and Freedom TM, where you would be walking around and people's reputation score would be hovering over their head. Mm-hmm. I would look at somebody like Ian, and I could immediately suss, you know, your credibility, your integrity. Oh, your body mass index and your blood sugar. I feel like I understand what you're saying, and certainly right now mobility is clearly, and personal is clearly, what's going on. But I don't think that that's to the exclusion of, you know, the expansion of processing into everything, which it creates this mesh of intelligence and awareness that we can then participate in as we walk around.
If you think about the Internet of Things and what's compelling about that, it actually fits with this personal thesis. I mean, what happened with gadgets, for lack of a better word, is they all got subsumed into the smartphone, right? There's that picture that's been floating around for ages of, like, all the stuff that is now in our smartphone.
Right, one thing.
And that's been the process of the last 6-7 years, is gadgets going away. But you think back where those gadgets come from. Those gadgets were all, like, video recorders, MP3 players, like, all these things were meant to plug into a PC. Because the problem with a PC is a PC ultimately wasn't mobile. Not a laptop isn't mobile. At the end of the day, you have to sit down, you have to put it on a desk, you have to turn it on and use it. And what a thing like an MP3 player did was it took a specific function of the PC, in this case, listening to music, and it made that specific function mobile. or a video recorder took a recording function and made it mobile. You could bring it back to the PC and you could plug it in and you could do stuff with it. What's been compelling about the smartphone is it took all that stuff and it also made the computer mobile. So that was all in one. You didn't need to, there was no point in having something separate and plugging it in.
Right.
And this, by the way, is why I think a no port MacBook Air makes a ton of sense. Like it's all on your phone anyway. But if you think about the, I don't know why my printer's going crazy. If you think about the Internet of Things, why I actually think gadgets are getting more interesting now, it's because previously gadgets made a immobile PC mobile. Now you can assume that everyone has a mobile computer with them all the time. And now what's interesting is all the objects that can't move can become smart in a meaningful way. Yeah. So your garage door can become smart. Your door, your lock on your door can become smart. Your car can become smart. And it becomes smart not independently, I think, in the long run. It becomes smart because it becomes smart when a smartphone gets close to it.
I remember talking very early on in this transition with Paul Otellini, who was then the CEO of Intel. And I said, what's the future of the personal computer in a world like this? He said, oh, we'll always be the hub. You're wrong.
Yeah.
And Intel.
So they thought
Intel's playing catch up on mobile all of a sudden. What a surprise. You have a great post. I want to point everybody to it, Ben Thompson, on Stratechery, called Mobile First, in which you talk about this Type C port, the single port MacBook. And actually, I want to take a break because this would be a good time to segue to our next subject, something you were very interested about. You talked to Hugo Barra, who was formerly the guy who did all the demos at Google and then up and left and went to a Chinese company, Xiaomi. He's the VP of international now at Xiaomi. And you talked to him on Friday about their strategy. They announced the new, was it called the Mi? The Mi Pad?
No, Mi Note.
Mi Note.
So, yeah.
Well, we're going to take a break. I know this was something that's near and dear to your heart, and I'd love to get your insight on this. I just wish we could get one in the United States. We'll have more in just a bit. Lots to talk about today. Our show today brought to you by Lynda.com. There's lots to learn, as you probably can see. The world is a rapidly changing place. Lynda.com empowers you to learn by giving you courses you can visit at your own pace. 4,500 courses now on all kinds of stuff. It started with web development and web design. That's what Lynda Wyman, who created Lynda.com, was all about. We used to interview her all the time on the screensaver. She's great. She expanded, though, to Photoshop, photography, design. Now they have courses in business skills, too, like negotiations and resume building and time management. Software training like Excel, WordPress, Photoshop, all their courses taught by the best people in the business. Burt Monroy. I mean, there is, if you're going to take a Photoshop class, you're taking it from the best in the business when you're studying Burt Monroy. We had him on Triangulation. He talked a little bit about his they've got free courses from Burt on Lynda.com, and then his more elaborate courses, including the step-by-step walkthrough of how he made his newest painting, Amsterdam Mist. This is a Photoshop master showing you how to do stuff with Photoshop you didn't even believe possible. There's also the weekly office workshop series, the Monday productivity pointers, photography 101. If you want to, it's for hobbies too. The creative quick tips series. That's Justin Seeley. He gives you a little 5-minute tutorials on improving your creative skills in Photoshop and Illustrator and WordPress. What's your plan for 2015? Would you like to get a better job? Would you like to get a raise? Would you like to explore a new hobby, set new financial goals? Lynda.com will get you there. Every single Lynda course has a complete searchable transcript, so you can jump right to the part of the course you want. It's easy to take the courses with you with the Lynda app on your iPhone, your iPad, your Android device. So many great topics in programming, there's just music and music theory and design. You can see I've got a bunch of courses going on. I got Burt Monroy's. I'm up and running with Lightroom 5, the Swift programming language. I think this old Excel one I could get rid of now. Excel 2007 essential training. That didn't work out so well for me. I'm not good at spreadsheets, it turns out. Do something good for yourself in 2015. Sign up for our free trial, 10 days of complete access to everything at lynda.com. Go to lynda.com/twit2 with your membership, unlimited access to every course,
and Android and iOS playback and all the new courses. They add hundreds of courses every week. LYNDA.com/twit and the number 2. Twit 2. Cinema 4D. Wow. Up and running with Snapchat. I need a course on how to use Snapchat. If your kids are using Snapchat, you want to know what that all that Snapchat's all about. They got a course on it. LYNDA.com/twit2. Xiaomi is a really interesting story. I think sometimes people feel like they're a copycat company, Ben. Tell us, is Xiaomi the number one hardware phone manufacturer in China?
I think the latest numbers are that they're number 3 in the world behind Apple and Samsung, which
not just China, the world.
Right. Well, I mean, but they sell almost completely into China. I think 98%
of sales. And I look at some of these phones. I think what did we get, Jason? We got a
the Mi 4,
I believe it was. Yeah. It was really, I mean, it would sell hugely in the US.
Yeah, it was really nice. I liked it a lot.
Why don't they? What are they planning to come into the U.S. or the rest of the world?
Rest of the world, yes, not the U.S. and probably not Western Europe, at least for a while.
Huh.
Their kind of core thing to date has been to offer very well specced phones that are nice for a price that's half the cost of a top of the line Samsung or iPhone.
They do TVs too. They do tablets,
right? Well, that's what's interesting is it's kind of been a question is how is this company going to make money? And you know the whole thing is they're going to make money on services, but the problem is that doesn't really add up because when it comes to services in China, all the money is being made by Tencent with their WeChat application. It's being made by Baidu, who dominates search there. And there's really not a lot of money left over to be made in services the way we traditionally think about them. And so that kind of leaves the money. Xiaomi just raised another round at the end of last year, valuing them at $46 billion, $1 billion larger than Uber to take the title. And the question is like, well, where is this valuation coming from? How are they going to make money? And that's what makes the company so interesting. I actually think there is a... like any startup, it's not guaranteed, but I think there is a very compelling opportunity here. And it actually gets back to what we were just talking about, which is the Internet of Things and what happens if you start a company with the assumption that the smartphone is the center of everything. And what Xiaomi is doing, and it's interesting that you know about, and you mentioned things like the TV, or they sell things like an air purifier, or they sell like routers. Their last announcement on Thursday, which I was in Beijing to attend, they opened it up by talking about their partnership with Midea, which makes air conditioners and things like that.
Although when you drive through Beijing, everybody has an air conditioner.
Well, everybody's air conditioner and everybody certainly needs an air purifier.
It's a very big business there.
Yeah. But what's happening here is the way I wrote about this a couple weeks ago is – It's incomplete to think of Xiaomi as a smartphone company.
Right.
They're much more of a lifestyle company, and they're a lifestyle company for a specific set of customers. There is customers that are can't afford an iPhone, care about things like specs and features and stuff like that, and tend to be young and about to move into their own places, about to buy their first homes.
Interesting. So this is really their first computer.
Right. Well, it's their first computer. It's the center of their existence. And Xiaomi has to a very impressive extent, in a way that few other companies in technology broadly, much less in China, have built a very strong brand and a meaningful brand, a brand that people like ascribe to and are proud to be associated with. It's very Apple-like in that way. Now you have these people that are moving out there are going to start buying things, and what kind of things are going to buy? They're going to buy the Xiaomi air purifier. They're going to buy the Xiaomi TV. They're going to buy the Xiaomi air conditioner. And a lot of these Xiaomi's not going to make even the majority of these. They're going to be white labeled or to be sold with partnerships. But you think about this, what's happening now, they have all this stuff and they're all smart. They're all tied together via software through Xiaomi software, the MIUI. What you actually have here is an Android maker that's actually building meaningful stickiness and a meaningful moat around their products, because they have actual physical products that are tied together by software And now it actually is different to own a Xiaomi phone than it is to own something else. And it's very, and so you think about it, it's really almost the first Internet of Things company. They're selling you the whole house. They're selling you the whole lifestyle.
They have home automation too.
No, exactly. And, yeah. And so it's the sort of company that, that can only make sense if it was born with the assumption that the phone is at the center. And right. That's the advantage of being a
very
startup. They just started four and a half years ago.
Right.
And now you have this week, they had a new announcement, the Mi Note Pro, or the Mi Note Pro, an unfortunate name to be sure. We can talk about that. We can talk about that in a moment. But it's a excellent phone. It is not a copycat of anyone. The build quality is a significant step up from the Mi 4, which was already, you know, it was good.
I like the Mi 4, and battery life is the best in the business.
Yeah, the build quality is amazing. The specs are amazing.
So Mi UI is Android. How is it? How pure is it? How much like would we recognize it?
To a degree. I mean, it looks different, and there's lots of skins you can apply to. This is something that's very popular in Asia broadly, is to do this sort of customization. So it's a little complicated. Within China, it's AOSP Android, and it has all their own services. It has Baidu services, I think. It has the Xiaomi App Store.
No Google services.
Well, you can download the Google Play Store.
Oh, I mean,
it just doesn't, but no, they don't come pre-installed.
Right.
And so outside China, like in India, where they're making a really big push right now, they greatly exceeded their expectations anyway, at least according to Hugo Berra, in the last 4 months of the year, last year. They outside China, they do run Google, Google's version of Android. You can do quite a bit of customization and still stay in bounds. You see that with Cynogen Mod, and you also see that with Xiaomi's external version.
Absolutely.
But it's okay there. And I think this is really hard for people to understand, because people are so stuck on the Android versus iOS battle that's kind of self-contained within the smartphone. And whereas Xiaomi's differentiation isn't the smartphone, it's the ecosystem of stuff that is tied together by the smartphone.
Do they sell music? Do they have a music store?
They do. They have a music store. They have a video store. They have all those sort of services. So, and they are looking to make money from those types of services. Yeah. But I think you have to look at them from a different frame of reference to kind of understand what they're doing and what they're trying to accomplish.
In terms of the data that they collect, are they monetizing that in any way, or is it just sort of... You could build up a very accurate profile of someone's personality by how they, if you tie in their phone, their TV, their music and video buying habits, the health, and they use their their air purifier. Are they actually marketing that data as well, or is it just being stored, or is it private?
Not that I know of. I mean, I would presume they're probably storing it. But I mean, the other thing too is we're still at the very much like you're seeing the outlines of this strategy come into picture. There is a very long road of execution and actually seeing it work out to justify that valuation. But at least I think you can start to see what they're trying to do. And that's certainly an option for something they could do. I don't think they're doing anything like that now. But
why not the U.S. market?
Well, there's a couple reasons. One, just from a business perspective, the U.S. market, everyone has appliances. Everyone has their homes.
Right.
And it's not that big of a market. Like, I'm serious. If China and India combined, which are their two main markets right now, are 12 times the size of the U.S. market. Like, and this is...
It's like asking, why not the Madagascar market? Why? When?
No, it's true. I mean...
Isn't that interesting? It's something hard for us in the U.S. to get used to.
Well, it's one size, and two, it's people that are buying this stuff now. They're buying appliances, and there's people that are getting their first computers, and it's already very mobile first in a way that the U.S. isn't. The U.S. has much more of a PC hangover, as it were, and if you go from no computer to a smartphone, you're gonna buy into that mobile lifestyle in a much more substantial way than if you're going from a PC that you've used for many years to a smartphone, which is more mobile and better, but you still have a lot of old habits and ways of doing things. That's number one. Number two is IP. They have an IP problem. Some of it's legitimate, some of it's not legitimate. That's a philosophical discussion.
Isn't that sad, though, that the patent wars keep us from getting the best stuff?
Well, I tend to fall on this side of things when it comes to Xiaomi and Apple PR has done an excellent job of framing Xiaomi, I think, in the tech readers' conscious.
Yeah.
I think people in the media are probably familiar with that. on one hand, I'm uncomfortable with technology patents in general. And the reason is because the whole a patent is inherently a bad thing. It is a government granted monopoly.
Right.
And monopolies aren't great. The reason why patents exist is because they're meant to spur innovation, to make it worthwhile to invent, to do new things. In technology, no one needs a spur. Like, there's so many gains from being first to being, you know, to making the market that I feel pretty confident that if there were no patents, there would be no slowdown in innovation. And if you question the fundamental premise, then it's like, well, yeah, you're right. Why should Xiaomi be limited in this perspective? So I do have a problem from the we have to pay license fees perspective. From a copying perspective, that's something that Xiaomi, quite frankly, needs to do better at. I think it's a cultural thing in some respects. The idea of copying isn't nearly as frowned upon or even thought to be a bad thing in China. And a lot of this is very much a cultural thing. I mean, you look back through history and the way art was valued, copying is not considered a morally bad thing like it kind of is in the West. And as long as I'm on my soapbox and monologuing, the fact of the matter is when the U.S. came to power, we stole a whole lot of IP from England and lots of other places.
Yes.
And it's a little hypocritical for us to be on our high horse now. It's understandable, but it's certainly hypocritical.
No, I mean, I'm with you. Charles Dickens had to spend a lot of time coming over to America, doing book tours, doing lecture tours, just to try and get his earnings up in the U.S. because the minute American printers got hold of his stuff, they just slapped out their own copies and didn't. And you can see it from that perspective. But over the last 10 years in this country, IP is more about, you know, lawsuits to protect your market than it is about rewarding the inventors of anything.
It's just
that and it's got way out of control.
Yeah. Serenity, I'm sorry.
Oh no, I mean I generally agree with all of that. The last couple of years, you know, I have a couple of people who I'm pretty close with in the community who are, you know, app developers, and the fact that they, you know, the recent the patent trolls going after them for things like pull to refresh, it's very frustrating.
Yeah. Is the problem with Xiaomi, I think, from a copycat perspective, is it's a business problem. I mean, they may be okay in China. Their Lei Jun, their founder, is a rock star, and people follow them, and like they'll be on their social media presence is excellent, and they sell, and so it works very well there. But if they want to go abroad and succeed in a meaningful way, like they're going to need to depend much more on the worth and value of their products, and copying doesn't help in that respect at all, and it actively hurts.
Look at this headline from Engadget, which is a perfect example of how the tech press buys Apple's line. Xiaomi mocks Apple with its very own premium phablet, as if Apple created the phablet.
Of course.
Well, they were late to the game. They just got into that.
The first iPhone, when it came out from a hardware perspective, was junk. Sorry, compared to the rest of it. Yeah. But it looked pretty.
In other words, Apple can dictate this storyline here in the United States, and it's picked up.
It's interesting. I think it's a little more complicated than that. I think that Apple and has been active pushing the line that Xiaomi rips off Apple. And I mean, Johnny Ive said something very explicit in that regard, and how he was outraged and offended. And I think I agree that particularly with the most recent generation, the Mi 4, Xiaomi took way too many design cues from Apple. And that said, from a business model perspective, they're already very different. From a software perspective, they're very different. To actually use a device is completely foreign compared to an iPhone. But I think it's justifiable, and I think that it's a problem for Xiaomi from a hardware perspective. That said, I think Xiaomi is aware of this, and this new product, again, the name's unfortunate. They've had a Note for a while. For what it's worth, almost all big phones in China, by all the no-name manufacturers, are all called Notes. Like, that's kind of the name for a phablet now. But, I mean, we all know where that came from. It's a stupid move, to be perfectly frank. But that said, the hardware is totally unique. It's glass on both sides. And when I say glass on both sides, I mean it's like an iPhone 5. It's curved. It feels unlike other phones that I've felt. And that's a good
price
thing for them.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what's really interesting. The regular Note is $270, I think, which that said, I think is still more expensive than any Xiaomi phone has been. They also did a top of the line one, but they don't expect to sell many, but it's basically the best of the best. It's got the Snapdragon 810. It's got 4 gigabytes LDDR RAM or something like that, which is like brand new to market. It's super expensive. Mm-hmm. But that's selling for over $500, which is
still half again, what Apple would charge.
Yeah.
It's interesting. It's both really cheap and really expensive. It's really cheap compared to other manufacturers. It's really expensive compared to Xiaomi.
Yeah. Thank you for that great insight on Xiaomi. I really want to keep covering it because I think it's fascinating.
I think there's lots of challenges in thinking about it. I mean, one is just the market perspective.
Right.
I mean, it's a different market. The way everything that works there is different. Two, it's the business model perspective. They're not following an Apple or Google business model. It's something different. And then three, it's this mobile perspective. It's really a company that only makes sense if you start with the premise that a computer is an accessory. It's not the center of what you do. And I think for geeks in particular, that's something that's really hard to wrap your head around. But that's very much the reality for more and more people in the West and a vast majority of people in a place like China.
How do you rate them going internationally? I mean, Indonesia and India, India in particular, a tough market for China's a crack, I would have thought.
They have it's hard for any Chinese company in India for lots of reasons. But they've done quite well. I mean, this is not object information, but according to, Hugo Barra, they went into India with 100,000 units, assumed that would last them for 6 months and sold out in 2 weeks. And something they've had a lot of success with in India, their product resonates, I think. Again, you hesitate to get too much into country, stereotypes, things like that. But their marketing is kind of a geeky in a positive sort of sense. Like they mark themselves on their components and on their specs and being a very good value for the fantastic performance that you get. And that's something that they found that really resonates in India. And they've made good inroads into that. And what they do is they lead with these high-end products from a spec perspective that are still great value. And then they come in the bottom with their Redmi line, which is like $100. So you get a smartphone for $100. It has the Xiaomi brand and software and interaction with the ecosystem. But obviously it's built on a MediaTek chip, although they do have Qualcomm ones as well. It's lower cost components. And that actually makes up the volume of their business. But it's very much they have a very clear segmentation. They really build their brand on the Mi brand, and then they have a fill the market perspective with the Redmi. And it's been pretty successful to date. I mean, their growth slowed slightly last quarter. Part of that is because they've just so thoroughly eviscerated Samsung, in particular in China, that they need to go international. But I think they've pulled back from other markets actually mainly because they want to spend so much more time on India. And it's a pretty nice option to go from a 1.3 billion market to a 1.1 billion one.
Yeah. We're going to take a break. We've got Ben Thompson from Stratechery from the Register, Ian Thompson. I know it's confusing. The Thompson twins, I'd like to call you. And weren't there three in the Thompson twins?
There were.
Very confusing. And Serenity Caldwell, who's just getting over her cold from CES. Oh, I hear it. I feel it. I sympathize. We had a fun week this week on Twit, having fun with some David Cameron stuff, among other things. Take a look. That was fast, but it was a quick week.
Previously on Twit, Tech News Tonight.
UK Prime Minister David Cameron has promised a new law that would either ban apps that encrypt messages or force the creators of such apps to provide a backdoor for the UK government.
So Cameron said, we are not going to permit encrypted communications like WhatsApp, like iMessage.
Security Now.
Leo, I'm worried about the future.
Marketing Mavericks.
Racing, specifically of all sports, is so brand intensive.
Think of any other sport that literally logos are thrown in the audience's face nonstop. And the audience love it.
Tech News Today.
Top scientists have signed a letter of warning talking about artificial intelligence and the potential dangers. Now, the big question here, Mike, is whether Skynet's going to honor this letter once Skynet comes online.
Triangulation.
10 basics that you think everybody knows, but right. They really don't.
Even Bill Gates doesn't know.
I'll bet he doesn't know about the number keys when you're watching YouTube.
No, I have no idea. What can you do with them?
Oh, thank God I got Leo on one of these.
This is your brain. This is your brain on Twit. Any questions?
So great talking to David Pogue. It was nice to see him. Hey, by the way, triangulation tomorrow, Ron Wayne, the guy who was one of the founders of Apple Computer with Steven Wozniak and Steven Jobs and who sold his share, he got a little nervous. Said, I don't think this thing is going to work out for $800. This is an amazing story. Ron Wayne joins us tomorrow on triangulation to talk about that and lots more. We've got a big week ahead. Mike Elgin, what's coming up?
Coming up this week, tomorrow's Monday, January 19th, and it's the last day you'll be able to buy the Explorer edition of Google Glass. Google says they'll launch a more consumer-y version of Glass at some unknown date in the future. To buy the current version of Glass, just search the Google Play Store for Google Glass. IBM and Netflix report earnings on Tuesday, January 20th. eBay reports on Wednesday, January 21st. Also on Wednesday is Microsoft's big Windows 10 rollout. Megan Maroney and I will cover the event live starting at around 8:45 a.m. Pacific at live.twit.tv. And finally, the data storage company Box, Inc. will officially launch their IPO on Friday, January 23rd. That's what's coming up this week. Back to you, Leo.
Thank you, Mike Elgin, our news director and host of Tech News Tonight. Tech News Today every Monday through Friday, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern Time, 1800 UTC, your daily dose of tech news. We'll be covering that Windows announcement, Windows 10 consumer preview, not only with Mike and Megan in the morning. We'll go through the lunch hour, then they go to closed sessions. But we're doing a special edition of Windows Weekly. Paul Thurrott and Mary Jo Foley are there. And we'll have the details of their briefing about 4:30 Pacific, 7:30 Eastern Time, 24:30 UTC on twit.tv. So a special late edition of Windows Weekly on Wednesday. There's also a note that the OnePlus folks are going to have 2-hour invite-free sales of OnePlus on Tuesday, January 20th. So just I can't remember what time it is. You should check the OnePlus site. They've done this before, and when you get there, it's usually a crazy. All right, is the OnePlus still a thing, the OnePlus One? We all had them and kind of moved on.
I'm moving back because I just shattered my
Nexus 6.
Oh. But you know what? I'm not too sad to move back because it was a great phone.
I am actually tempted to buy another one. I love the OnePlus. And nothing out, at least in the U.S., maybe the Mi 4, but nothing in the U.S., has anywhere near the battery life of the OnePlus. And Cyanogen has said, Steve Kondek, who is Cyanogen, has said that they're doing a lollipop version for the OnePlus One, which will be available next month. Android 5.0. CM mod is great, or whatever they call it. CM 11 or 12 is great on the OnePlus. It's just a wonderful operating system. I really like it.
I got one and the SIM tray was broken and they wanted to charge me $270 to repair it.
It's a cheap phone, so they give you no support.
Yeah.
Basically.
So I'm scarred.
I think that it's an interesting story, and I never really did quite figure out why they have never gone beyond this invite system. Doesn't look like they ever will. Somebody said, well, they're such a small company, they just want to make sure they have sales for everyone they manufacture. For a while, I thought it was because the screen was the same as on the iPhone 6 Plus and that they were just constrained by Apple's huge demand. But they're still invite only.
Well, I'm ramping's hard. I mean, it's...
Yeah.
It's,
but they've been ramping for a year. That's not ramping. That's just floating. That's hovering.
No. I think... we see companies like Apple do it so easily.
I know.
That we forget that, especially for a new company.
Some people are complaining on this Nexus 6, by the way, the back's coming off
There are some maybe some manufacturing problems with the Nexus 6, and that shattering is not unusual.
Just yesterday, somebody on Google Plus was like, "Did this happen to you?" I'm like, "No, thank God,
not till tomorrow."
And I saw it today, and I was like, "Man, if I could go back in time tomorrow."
What did you hit it on?
It shattered on the concrete right in front of the front door on my way into work here. It hit an uneven part of the sidewalk, so I don't even think a case would have saved it. I think it was just destined.
If a point hits glass hard enough,
yeah. And, you know, I'm tall, so it hits from a higher distance. So.
Yeah, you dropped it from like 8 feet.
Practically. Almost, give or take.
I want to see. I'm trying to find your picture of it. Oh, my God.
That's
one spidered screen.
That's it. Oh. And I tell you, the sound it made when it hit, I still hear it echoing through my brain. Because it isn't just like an object hitting the ground. No. It's
the sound of a heart breaking.
It's like banshees screaming, you know.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we have some final stories and final words. But first, a word from Gazelle.com. Jason, you might be interested in this.
Yes, I'm listening.
Gazelle's the place you go, and we've mentioned this many times before, to sell your old gadgets. They'll give you cash for your old gadgets, your old iPhones, your Galaxy phones, your iPad, your Surface. But they also now sell stuff. You may wonder, well, what happens to all this stuff people trade in at Gazelle? Well, Gazelle takes the very best, the creme de la creme, and sells it. So that is great. They have two conditions, certified like new and certified good. You could save some money when you go certified good because there's some gentle signs of wear. But I got to tell you, everything that they sell has already been put through their rigorous 30-point inspection to make sure they're fully functional. They work as expected. Look at that, $85 for a new Moto X or a certified pre-owned Moto X. They're also backed by a 30-day risk-free return policy, so you're never on the hook. See, if OnePlus had that, you wouldn't have had a problem, Ben. Got a new gadget? Maybe you got something for the holidays? Gazelle will buy your old iPhone, Galaxy phone, iPad, MacBook, trading in your devices after the holidays. Well, that's like just getting like a second gift. Like, here's some cash in your pocket. Don't throw it in a drawer. That's like taking $100 bills and just stuffing them in your shorts. You gotta go to Gazelle, GAZELLE.com. Risk-free. If you forget to wipe your data, they'll do it for you. They even buy broken iPhones and iPads. And I tell you, they've paid out now $200 million to over 1 million customers at Gazelle.com. Fast shipping, fast processing. Shipping's free. GAZELLE. Look at that. Some money off their iPhone 6 and go out and buy a Mi Note. Gazelle.com. Google Glass dead. You saw that they're halting sales tomorrow. Last chance. $1,500. You think there's like a rush of people saying, I got to get my glass.
Well, I really need it.
I need my glass.
Well, no, when they first put them on sale at I.O., I called up my then wife-to-be, and it was just like, how sold you are, on the honeymoon? You know, I mean, could they just delay
or
for
Google
a year
Glass.
Or so,
yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it was it's a cute idea killed by bad implementation and bad marketing, and it's just not there yet.
And maybe not. And maybe, let's face it, a product that just doesn't appeal.
Well, just to go back to before, it inserted itself in your actual
life.
It made itself the center instead of
sitting back, making my life better.
Right, exactly.
Is there a way to design this that it doesn't do that?
I'm fundamentally skeptical of anything on your face in the long run, just because it's too intrusive. I mean,
right.
Maybe when we get to contact lenses that are virtual reality, we'll have something to talk about. But,
no, it's so super distracting. And on top of that, you know, it feels alienating.
You
it
look
feels
like
a little
an,
bit
let's
orgish.
Face it. You look like an ass.
Yeah.
When you wear glass. I just made that up.
But also you make other people feel uncomfortable.
Yeah, like you're staring at them.
The big mistake they made was either they should have left the camera out the front of it,
right,
or they should have put a clear cap over the camera so that if you're wearing these things, at the moment, if you're wearing these things, people think they're being videoed the whole time.
They have
even
no idea.
If they're not.
Yeah.
Whereas if you didn't have the camera, if you had a cap over it, you'd just be, whoa, check out the gargoyle wearing the glasses, rather than, oh, are they possibly recording me? And I think that caused a social backlash against it, but there just wasn't a clear use case for it. It would have been one of those things that just like, yep, would have been, you know, this would be great in a geek discussion, but in the widest
once you actually made it, it was like, yeah, not so great.
Yeah. You know,
actually, and I have to say, as I was kind of thinking smartwatches were going to go down the same road, but I had a lot of the functionality of Glass is the notifications always available, and I like Android Wear a lot. I wear it all the time. I don't see you wearing a watch.
No, I tried the smartwatch for the first month. I did a month sitting around with it, and I found it made me incredibly rude because every time there was a notification coming in, I was checking my watch. And it's perfect. You know, it's one of those Twitch things that you do. But right. If you're talking to somebody, it's incredibly rude to be constantly looking at your watch the whole time.
I'm sorry. What were you saying?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no. Right.
Can I ask, does Android Wear, because I've only very briefly played around with the Moto 360, does it allow you to select certain notifications?
Yes.
So like, yeah, VIP?
Two ways. There's an app you can use on the phone, but also many notifications, if you swipe them over, it says, you don't want to see this ever again, do you? And you hit yes, and then it won't ever come back. So you can really choose. You can't choose, like, when the phone rings, anybody's going to show up. So you can't say, I only want to see my VIPs like when the phone rings or texts. But by app, you can say, I don't want to see notifications from that app.
But you've still got to carry around a smartphone.
And you still have to carry around a smartphone.
So you've still got to get your phone.
Well, I did wear the Samsung, whatever it was, Gear that had a phone built into it for a while. That was really awful.
Yeah, because you also got to have a Samsung phone to go with it.
It's too much.
It was huge, yeah. It was like wearing a curved iPhone on your wrist. I feel like Apple's going to have some competition. I think Android Wear, because it's been out for a long time, they've learned a lot. I think it's actually a pretty useful smart product. Looks good. Looks maybe not as well as an Apple Watch, but looks good. And the Apple's going to have some competition. Not that I'm not going to buy one. I'll just have, thank God I have two wrists. That's all I can say.
You just stack it up. You do the super futuristic style. Yeah. 2015 style has to be somewhere.
Hey, you want to buy a watch?
Yeah. But, you know, I think Android Wear, from what I've seen of it and what I've played with it, is really cool. My main beef is, like, the Moto 360, it's like this on my wrist. Like, it looks like I'm wearing a Power Rangers bracelet or something. It just
You should see the LG one. I tried that. My wife called it a woman repeller. I mean, it's just like huge.
Well, these aren't exactly chick magnets. I will grant you that. I feel like Apple maybe has the right idea. They have two sizes for each edition, right? A little bit smaller one. You know, you got
38 and the 42. Yeah. And the 38 actually fit on my wrist.
Yeah. See, there you go. So
the thing I'm most interested in, I think I you're onto something where you talk about the tons of notifications being distracting. Anything like that, I think is not going to be where this wins. If it wins at all. Because a smartphone, because think about what is the big problem with a smartphone? The big problem is pulling it out and the fact that it is kind of distracting.
But don't people, I don't know how it is in Taipei, but don't people just constantly, aren't they walking around looking into their smartphone all the time anyway?
Well, that's what's really compelling. I'm actually really interested in the, what do they call it? The taptic engine.
Yeah.
Or
taptic engine.
I thought the most compelling thing in the entire presentation was the idea of walking along with the Maps app and it tapping you in
the
direction you want to go.
Although Android Wear does do that. So if you
Android talks to you about it.
In fact, I did this in London. If you do some nav, I want to get to the Tower of London, the watch will then buzz you when it's time to turn left or right. It's great on foot. On driving probably wouldn't be useful, but on foot, it's actually really great, and it shows a little thing that says turn here. I found that incredibly useful.
I mean, the one thing I did really like about the smartwatch was we'd been out to dinner that night. My wife was driving, just like, directions home. And it just automatically, you know, gave us the thing.
Did you understand that when you said directions home?
Well, I wasn't that drunk. So.
Okay, cool. Get me out of here.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that really excites me about the Apple Watch is when it, like, at least I feel like when I pull out my phone to be like, oh, yeah, I'm going to get directions to go home. And then 3 minutes later, I find that I'm checking Twitter and maybe I've gotten directions by that point. Or maybe I've just gotten completely lost because the phone, you know, despite the fact that it is a single target app, you still have so much accessible on the phone that it's very easy to subconsciously just try and do a whole bunch of tasks. Whereas the watch.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. The watch is so single focused that either, you know, it buzzes you for something very specific, or you have to request something very specific. You can't just be like, I'm just going to play around. And it does feel, it feels less intrusive to me to general natural conversation than pulling a smartphone out and having a smartphone around.
I realize I figured out what the killer app on the phone is. I realize I very often pull out my phone hoping to be delighted and amazed, impressed, excited. And there, I look at it and I go, no, there's nothing here for me today. And I put it back in my pocket, maybe Instagram or Facebook. But somebody should make an app that just, you guarantee every time you tap it, you're delighted.
Adorable Kitten.
Adorable Kitten app. And then I would use it all the time. I'm just saying.
That was actually the rationale for Twitter putting in random tweets in your screen.
Right.
Just
yeah.
be more delightful. Scroll to the top. If you're doing that pull down, you want that dopamine hit.
And yes, dopamine. It's all about the dopamine, baby.
It's like Reddit R. I mean, it's just the most concentrated form of cuteness on the planet because everyone is piling in there.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, the whole watch. Also, don't you get irritated at having to recharge it every 24 hours?
No, I have to do that with everything. I go to bed, put my watch in its charger, put my phone in its charger, and then I can wake up. It's all done.
Yeah, but we're both old enough to remember a watch where you change the battery once a year.
Yeah, I know, but who cares?
I remember phones that lasted a week on a charge as well, and I have no desire to go back to that.
I remember when we used to boil soup in the fireplace. It doesn't necessarily have to stay that way, and I know it's not such a big deal. I know I never understood that, frankly. You just take it off. What do you? Oh, it's too much trouble to put it in the dock?
Well, no, but you've then got to carry the dock around with you.
No, I don't.
If
do
you
that.
Go off hiking for a week, you completely
That's one thing on the Moto 360. It is a Qi charging device. So any Qi charger will charge it wirelessly. That means, I've got those all over the place. So.
Yeah.
I love Qi.
I'm coming around to it myself. Actually, I've just got my first wireless charger.
It's pretty cool. You get the right charger.
Yeah.
It's good. Monument Valley. I love this. US2 Games was unusually transparent in talking about, this was the game of the year on iOS and Android, Monument Valley. I'm sure you all played it. Great puzzle game. They talked about how much money they made, how much it cost to make, how many sales they had. 2.4 million sales. That was mostly iOS, 1.7 million iOS. Only 300,000 on Google, although they came later to Android. Big day, though, when Amazon, the day that Amazon gave it away for free on their app store, 407,000 sales. But this is the sad news. Lots of piracy. 10 million unique devices, which means 75% of all installs were pirated installs. Doesn't mean they didn't make money. Highest one-day revenue was on launch day on iOS. They talk about how much it costs to make, which is kind of interesting.
That was unusual. Yeah,
I really love this. It took them 55 weeks to develop the original game. Cost $852,000. It's 8 team members based in London. Then they did the Forgotten Shores add-on, and that actually cost took 30 weeks almost and cost $549,000. So the total cost, just a little bit about, I don't know, I'll do some quick math, $1.4 million, but they made $5.8 million.
Yeah.
Not so bad, I think. Good return. Most of it, 81% of it from iOS.
Well, this was the problem. Android seemed to have much bigger problems with piracy.
Right.
And
you got to wonder, where were those 10 million unique devices? Were they mostly Android devices?
Almost certainly, I would have thought. Apple's got such a tight lock on its app ecosystem, whereas Android is all over the place on it. And that's bad news for malware, and it's bad news for piracy.
I should point out that 10 million installs, some of those are legit family sharing. I install it on everything. I buy it once and put it on all my phones.
Right.
So but that doesn't say much. That actually doesn't say the full cost of the piracy. 50% of players who started the game completed it. That's a very high number. I'm surprised.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say for a mobile game, that is.
Yeah.
2.2 million totems were drowned. I don't know what that is, but that probably makes sense.
R.I.P. totem.
And what's interesting is only a quarter of the players bought the second pack, the puzzle pack.
Yeah.
Did you finish the game? You obviously did.
Oh, yeah. I love that game.
It's a great game.
And it's adorable. And you know what? I appreciate it in the day and age where, you know, you've got your Flappy Bird, you've got your, you know, Desert Golf, you've got your crazy games where you are playing forever and drowning into, you know. But at the same time, like, Monument Valley is self-contained and it's a little cute story and it's delightful.
Yeah, it's challenging, it's thoughtful, but at the same time, it's soothing and calm. There's no timer. Instagram, 17 on iOS, 17,965 people posted their pictures of their of their quest on Instagram, just so you know. Only 14,000 on Twitter. So another big win for Instagram.
People with way too much time on their hands.
Look how I'm doing. I just love that. We're going to wrap it up. I want to make one little note. A young guy who worked for us for a couple of years and really very sad story passed away about a year ago. We've only just started learning about it thanks to Ewan Rankin on the British Tech Network, where Eric Lanigan made some appearances. He informed me about it, and he has created a condolence blog. He has spoken to Eric's dad. I was at first a little concerned. I don't want to announce somebody's passing unless we're absolutely sure. But Ewan says he spoke to Eric's dad, David, and did find out that Eric had passed away. Very sad story. Young guy, very passionate, very smart. Cared a lot about tech, and I know many of our Twit family members were big fans of Eric Lanigan. And he stopped kind of participating in social media a couple of years ago, and I think a lot of us wondered, you know, whatever happened to him. So sad to know. We now know. So please, if you were a fan, you can visit Ewan's website. It's britishtechnetwork.com. Ewan said his father would be interested in seeing a book of condolences, and so we've all left a little bit of something there, memories of Eric and so forth. It's very sad and a great loss, and so young. R.I.P. Eric Lanigan. That is it for this show. I thank you so much for being here. Ian Thompson came all the way from Great Britain 6 years ago to be on this show.
It's been a long and winding road, certainly.
But please come back. I didn't know you were in San Francisco.
No, happy to.
We love the Register, register.co.uk. Always snappily written, but lots of great information. It's a really great place to go. So thank you.
Oh, thank you.
For being here. Thanks so much for getting up early, Ben Thompson, and missing the game. I'm so sorry.
No, I didn't miss anything.
Yeah, apparently not. Okay, spoiler alert. I think the Seahawks are going all the way. When I saw last week, I know nobody wants to talk sport ball. But when I saw last week, they're blocking the punt. There's a guy comes running 100 feet down the thing and jumps over the line to block the punt. I thought, that's a team that really wants to win. All right. You don't care. Sorry about that, Ben.
This week in sports.
Aaron Rodgers is great. He's coming back. He'll be back next year. He's a young guy. Lots of future. Unfortunately, so is Russell Wilson. Serenity Caldwell is the queen of roller derby in beautiful Beantown. Did you have to take a little bit of a break to recover?
I did. I've actually not been on skates for 4 weeks. I've got tryouts next week. So, yeah, I got to get back to it.
What is there a website? How can we learn more about roller derby in Boston?
You can learn more about roller derby in Boston at bostonderbydames.com.
Of course you can.
you know, very, very simple like that.
I think roller derby is making a comeback. I know a lot of people who do this now.
So I've never heard of it until I came here, and it just looks like a big fight on wheels.
Yeah, so it's just... what could be more fun?
Yeah, both of you need to go see the Bay Area Derby Girls. I know their season's starting up in a couple months.
I grew up watching the Bay Area Bombers. You probably have no memory of them, but they were...
I know who they are, yeah.
And that was like a professional sport.
Yeah.
Is it only women that do this, or are there still guys who do...
There are men's teams and women's teams, yeah. There are two separate organizations.
But you are tough. You are tough.
I try to be.
What's your team?
My team is the Boston Massacre. We're the A-level travel team. We're ranked, I believe, 27th in the world.
Yes, look at this. There you go.
And I also play on a home team for Boston called the Cosmonauts. We're the best Soviet-themed space science team around.
I love the names. You're bested by only one team, the Arkham Horrors.
Yes.
The Cosmonauts. The Wicked Pisses, a classic Boston name, and the Nutcrackers. I don't know what that means, but maybe they like Christmas music.
Ballerinas who got kicked out of the academy.
That's it. So nice to have you, Serenity. You're great. imore.com. Thank you for being here. Thank you all for being here. We do Twit every Sunday afternoon, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 2300 UTC. Please stop by and watch. We love having you in the chat room. That's a lot of the fun of the show. And also, I get a lot of my best lines from the chat room. So come on in and visit. You can also visit us live in studio. Very nice studio audience today. All you have to do is email tickets at twit.tv. Hey, and we'll put a seat out for you. But if you can't do either of those, don't worry. On-demand audio and video is always available of all our shows on the network at twit.tv. That's our website. And wherever you get podcasts. And, of course, they're great apps on iPhone, Android, even Windows Phone and Roku. We got you covered. Just search for Twit. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time. Another Twit.
This is amazing.
Is in the can. Take care.
Doing the Twit.
Doing the Twit.